Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Streaming services take up the massive film and TV libraries of their corporate parents, it's becoming obvious that some of this material has not aged well. How the streamers handle this says a lot about the companies in charge, according to NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, who joins us now. Welcome back, Eric.
Hi.
We're going to start with Disney and its streaming service, Disney Plus. Disney has a number of films and old cartoons with a lot of cringe-inducing stereotypes. Here's a scene from the Disney film Dumbo with a flock of black crows.
What's cooking around here? What's the good news? What's frying, boy? Just look down here, brother.
And prepare yourself for a shock.
So how has Disney Plus handled this sort of thing?
Well, I'd say it's been in fits and starts. You know, when Disney Plus first debuted way back in 2019, they put a very basic kind of two-sentence advisory on some films that wasn't particularly obvious when you called up the movie to look at it. And now they have a more extensive content advisory that's several paragraphs long, and it appears on the screen for about 12 seconds before the movie starts. And it says, in part, quote, "This program includes negative depictions and/or mistreatment of people or cultures. These stereotypes were wrong then and are wrong now." So this advisory directs you to a spot on Disney.com, their website, called Stories Matter. And there they explain how they put together this group of experts to advise them on which films should get an advisory. And they list a few of them, like The Aristocats and Swiss Family Robinson. And films that get these advisory also get pulled out of the kids' profile section of Disney Plus, which is when some people notice the change.
And what's the response? Are there alternative ways Disney could have handled this?
Well, I think so. I think the content advisories on the movie should be specific to every film. Let viewers know exactly what scenes in Dumbo are problematic and why, and how those scenes are different from those in, say, Peter Pan. Give us a comprehensive list of all the films that are getting these advisories and talk publicly about why they're doing this. I mean, I've tried for a while to get somebody from Disney to talk with us about this subject, and so far they've refused. Maybe they're concerned about damaging their brand, but frankly, I think they could learn a bit from what a competitor like HBO Max did.
Explain how they've handled things.
Well, HBO Max had a challenge in Gone with the Wind, which has been criticized over many, many years for how it glorifies the Old South during the time before the Civil War when black people were enslaved. And they pulled the film off the library for a while and developed three videos explaining its problematic legacy. They also created this video advisory that airs for about 4.5 minutes before the film starts, explaining the problems in detail. And while they were pulling all this together, some executives talked about what they were doing.
You know, there are going to be many white people in particular who find these to be beloved works of art from their childhood, who are going to criticize these moves by these big brands. How do you think about all this?
Well, you know, people might say this is about cancel culture, but these films aren't getting canceled. They're not eliminated from Disney Plus, but people should know exactly what's in them so they're aware of the stereotyping and they're less affected by it. And some people might think this is coming out of nowhere, but HBO Max's advisory on Gone with the Wind pointed out the NAACP complained about that film when it was being made in 1938. People have been talking about these stereotypical depictions for many, many years. It's just taken a while to get the media companies to listen. And now that they are, let's have these discussions transparently so the audiences can learn.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I sip way too much drink. I don't think I can think. I won't try to tell lies. This blunt got me too high.
More people at younger ages are getting alcoholic liver disease, especially women under the age of 40. Advanced alcoholic hepatitis and cirrhosis can kill half or more of those who get it. Stress and isolation are feeding that trend. NPR's Yuki Noguchi joins us. Yuki, this spike, how big is it?
Well, it's big enough to alarm Jessica Mellinger. She's a liver specialist at the University of Michigan and says she's seen a 30% increase in hospitalizations there since the pandemic began.
In my conversations with my colleagues at other institutions, everybody is saying the same thing. They're like, yep, it's astronomical. It's just gone off the charts.
Off the charts, she says, and likely to get worse. And it's been young women driving that trend.
I personally switched all of my research in my liver transplant training year to alcoholic liver disease because I was seeing so many young people in the hospital. I was like, what is going on here? We're seeing kids in their late 20s and early 30s with a disease that we previously thought was kind of exclusive to middle age.
Well, it's tough to hear. We know you've been following one woman who struggled with this. Tell us her story.
Yeah, her name is Jessica Duenas, and I first met Duenas last April, just a few weeks into the pandemic. She'd just been named Kentucky's 2019 Teacher of the Year. She was 35 and in love with a new puppy and a new house in Louisville, and she was 4 months into recovery. She told me she was tired of leading a double life as a star in her field and a closet alcoholic. She used to drink almost a liter of liquor a night. That's 20 shots of bourbon or vodka, and 20 times the Centers for Disease Control's definition of heavy drinking for women. So by age 34, she'd developed alcoholic hepatitis.
I couldn't keep down any food. I was losing weight, and I mean losing weight that I wasn't seeking to lose. My belly was super sensitive. Like if I pressed on certain parts of it, it would hurt a lot. My eyes were starting to get yellowish.
She says she never drank at work. She's the first in her immigrant family to go to college. So she masked her problems by working extra hard. But that ate at her.
I felt so terrible about who I was as a person because of my addiction that I just threw myself into everything else to make everything else look good. But I hate myself. I want to die. I feel miserable. I feel like a less than person.
Sadly, that feeling of entrapment isn't uncommon. We'd spoken on April 11th of last year. At that time, her liver was healing. She frequented 12-step recovery meetings on Zoom. As she rang off, she sounded upbeat.
I am feeling really good right now, of course, because I chose not to go through this alone. Like my boyfriend, he's a very sweet person and he's been super great during this whole time. It's nice weather here. So, you know, we're going to take the dog out for a walk.
I called Duenas again recently. It turns out, shortly after we talked that day, she found her boyfriend. He'd relapsed on heroin.
He looked trapped and like completely out of control and completely outside of himself. Like that image is still frozen in my head.
2 weeks later, she went to his apartment.
Bang on the door, no response. Called the
neighbors phone, intervened, the police arrived.
And when they got the door open, he was gone. He had overdosed.
He died at 42. They'd plan to marry, have children.
Honestly, the next 8 months are such a blur, Yuki. Like, I was hospitalized about 8 times. My hospitalizations ranged from 3-day detoxes in emergency rooms to 1 5-week stay in a residential rehabilitation facility. I could not stay sober at all.
She took medical leave. She flipped her car over in a wreck. Duenas says she's normally politically active, but she only vaguely recalls last year's news from rehab. Protests over Breonna Taylor's shooting. Election day. By November, she was ready. She says her last drink was on Thanksgiving. Days later, she wrote about her secret in the Louisville Courier-Journal.
I'm Jessica. I'm the 2019 Kentucky State Teacher of the Year. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been suffering in silence for years.
Hundreds of people responded to her piece.
What I've noticed is quite a few of the women. Typically, they were either educators, they were moms, or they happened to be nurses or attorneys. Like, that was kind of like the groups that I ended up speaking with a lot.
These women poured their hearts out about managing crushing stresses of kids, work, and home. They also vented about pressures outside the home.
Imagine being a teacher who gets evaluated on how your students do, given the situation today. I mean, that makes me want to drink for them, you know? Like, that's a terrible pressure to be under.
Duenas says she's heard so many stories like hers. Now she's making a project of telling their stories on her website about recovery.
Yuki, why is this hitting so many young women like Duenas, especially right now?
Well, you know, a lot of it's what she talked about, you know, greater responsibilities at home and with remote school. That's all falling disproportionately on women. You know, domestic violence, eating disorders, isolation also makes those kinds of stresses and traumas worse. And you add to that, women's bodies just can't process as much alcohol as men. So psychiatrist Scott Winder sees patients with alcoholic liver disease, and he told me the pandemic is surfacing or creating trauma.
Whether this is early life sexual trauma or they're in a recent or ongoing abusive relationship, we see this link very, very closely. Just the sheer amount of trauma is really, really tragic.
You know, and then you have ads and pop culture validating the idea of drinking to cope. You know, mommy juice, rosé all day, wine down Wednesdays.
All right. So you're talking about then the medical problem of liver disease, and then on top of that, the underlying emotional struggles and addiction. So how do you treat all of that at the same time?
Well, that's exactly what makes this disease so complex. You know, usually treatment does not address both at the same time. But to treat severe liver disease, some people need a transplant, and you don't even qualify if you're still drinking. Haripriya Madhur is a hepatologist at Northwestern University.
Unfortunately, transplantation is finite. There's not enough organs to go around. What it unfortunately means is that many of these young people are, you know, may not survive and, you know, die very young in their 20s and 30s. It's horrific.
You know, that means they start drinking very early in life, and now they're facing a life or death struggle.
Yuki, thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Thank you.
That's NPR health correspondent Yuki Noguchi.
The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi-ho, the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
The COVID relief law is massive with far-reaching impact. It includes debt relief for America's black farmers, long denied government funding. Lisa Desjardins reports.
Judy, the new law allocates $5 billion for farmers of color. Most of that aims to erase their debt by paying 120% of their federally backed farm loans. The USDA tells NewsHour that that would help some 14,000 farmers, providing $175,000 in relief on average. The struggles of black farmers have been particularly acute. John Boyd is a farmer in Southwest Virginia, and himself he is also the head of the National Black Farmers Association. Let's start right away. How would this money help black farmers?
Well, it's going to give them a jump start in their farming operation. And first and foremost, this measure is historic in nature. Provides $5 billion, $4 billion for debt relief and other incentives, and $1 billion for outreach and to set up a commission and really look at the issues of discrimination at the United States Department of Agriculture, something I was trying to do for about 30 years. So this is a huge step in the right direction, especially for Congress and for the Ag Department.
You are a fourth generation farmer. You're talking about historic discrimination from the U.S. Department of Agriculture in particular. We're talking about loans denied, loans underfunded. Can you take us through how that actually worked for individual farmers like you? What did you experience?
Well, basically, many black farmers experienced blatant discrimination at the United States Department of Agriculture. And I, as a farmer, had my loan application torn and tossed in a trash can. I've been spat on by the person responsible for making farm loans and my county here in Mecklenburg County, Virginia. So discrimination was very, very pervasive, where many black farmers was just flat out denied an application. And they would come into the office, and the local official would say, "We don't have any money available." And when white farmers came in, they would process their loans less than 30 days. And for black farmers, it took 387 days on average to process our loans.
I have to circle back. You were spat at by a federal official?
Yes. Chewing tobacco. He's chewing tobacco juice. He spat on my shirt. And when they came out, the USDA civil rights person investigated him. They asked him, "Did you spat on Mr. Board's shirt?" He said, "Well, yes, he accidentally missed his spat can." They asked him, "Did he have problems making loans to black farmers, that he only made two that particular year?" And he said, "Well, yes, I think they're lazy and look for a paycheck on Friday. That's the type of discriminatory demeanor that prevented black farmers from prospering in this country when we were denied for access of credit based on his race. So he would only see black farmers on Wednesday. So we named it Black Wednesday in our county. All of our letters had 9 a.m. Wednesday, so-and-so. And he would speak loudly and boastfully and downward towards elderly black farmers, calling them boy. So these people were preachers and deacons and leaders in their community. And this county supervisor was referring to him as a boy and how he wasn't going to lend us any of his money. And if you quote me right, I believe this is the government's taxpayers' money, not his money. So that's the type of discrimination we were facing, and not just in my county, but this was a national epidemic, and I would like to call it a national disgrace, an embarrassment for our country that we live in.
You know, the statistics are just really hard to grasp. Black farmers in this country from 1910 to 1997 lost 90% of their acreage. I wonder, do you think this money will actually reverse the problem? Meaning, will it expand the number of farmers of color? Or does this money just sort of kind of stem the tide and stop things from getting worse?
Well, I'm hopeful that we will have some time to regroup. So if a farmer can have his debt removed or forgiven, that gives that farmer a little bit of time to look at his farming operation, revamp, regroup. And it also gives us an opportunity to stop some of the foreclosures that have been happening against black farmers. So we'll be able to keep more black farmers on the farm and also give them the opportunity to rebuild their farming operation. And that's what I've been after the whole time with my policy work.
What do you say to white farmers who see this as reverse discrimination and they say they're struggling also?
And I could hear somebody saying that. And, you know, but $29 billion that went out under the previous administration, the Trump administration, black farmers and farmers of color virtually absent. Billions and billions of dollars in loans and subsidies and debt forgiveness. Black farmers have been left out of the equation for decades. What do you call that is my question to them. And why, when they hear about this discrimination, why didn't some of those farmers speak out and said, you know what? We do need to treat black farmers with dignity and respect. That's my question. And I'm not against them receiving the loans when the act of Mother Nature shows her beautiful face and floods and all of these things. We want the same thing. And if you were treating black farmers fairly and equally, we wouldn't need a special bill here in the year 2021.
John Boyd, soybean farmer and president of the National Black Farmers Association. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That there was no such place. I had a vague idea that Rio de Janeiro was a place, so I kind of kept that in the back of my mind in reserve. And if all these other places fail, I could probably wind up join the Navy or something and go to Rio, and I could escape for a few minutes from being black. And a lot of black people thought that way in the back of their minds. They were looking for a place. That's the gist of what I'm saying. But the racists, this thing called white supremacy over a period of years, about 1957 while I was in Japan, I began to realize that you got to turn around and just grab it. It's no place to run.
Brazil is taking over as the new global epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic. It has registered more than 284,000 deaths, the world's second highest number. More people are dying in Brazil every day than in the U.S. from the coronavirus. Infections are surging, overwhelming hospitals and funeral services. As NPR's Philip Reeves reports, many fear that an even greater catastrophe is looming.
Presta atenção no que está acontecendo.
Pay attention to what's happening, says Dimas Urban. Our health service is collapsing. People are going to die. Urban is mayor of Pirassununga, a city in southeast Brazil. This is a video he's posted to try to persuade people to take precautions.
O Covid está aí, e quem não acredita nele é porque é ignorante.
The collapse Urban talks about is now threatening most of Brazil because of the worsening pandemic. IC units are close to full or overflowing. Yet the government vaccination programs barely started, says Denise Igaré, an infectious disease specialist.
The vaccination is going really, really slow, although we do have the capacity and the infrastructure to do much better than what we are doing.
Maiane Brito is a nurse who travels around northeast Brazil vaccinating people in remote villages. She says when she meets people,
elas riem com os olhos quando falar, porque é momento muito único.
She can see the joy in their eyes, yet many are also worried.
Infelizmente, a vacina não é suficiente, não está vindo suficiente, está sendo liberada aos poucos.
There just aren't enough vaccines, says Brito. At present, Brazil only has two types, AstraZeneca and the Chinese-made CoronaVac.
These two ones are not sufficient to respond to the size, to the magnitude of the epidemic in Brazil now. We are missing more vaccines, more doses.
That's Dr. Margarete Dalcomo, a respiratory disease expert at Brazil's research institution, Fiocruz. Brazil's health ministry says it can get 560 million doses of various vaccines by the end of the year. Dalcomo says that's too late.
We have to vaccinate the Brazilian population now, in this month, not waiting for the rest of the year, 1 year, to vaccinate Brazil.
Until vaccines start flowing in, Brazil only has one other weapon against COVID. Shutdowns and other social distancing measures are being imposed by governors and mayors. Some are desperately urging people, this time, to stick to the rules.
O que é mais importante é 48 horas de uma loja funcionando ou vida humana. Desculpe.
What's more important? Asks Rui Costa, governor of Bahia State, during a tearful TV appeal. Keeping a shop open for a couple of days or human lives? Brazilians are divided. Supporters of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro are protesting lockdowns by driving around the streets in giant convoys. Bolsonaro no longer calls COVID a little flu.
O efeito colateral direto do lockdown é o desemprego.
Yet he still insists shutting the economy causes more suffering than the virus. Brazil's doctors watch in dismay. Pedro Halal says they're trying to head off a catastrophe that could spread to other countries.
Brazil now represents a threat to global public health, in addition to obviously representing a threat to our own population.
Halal is one of Brazil's leading epidemiologists. Several variants of the virus are already circulating. Halal fears other, more dangerous variants will emerge.
The virus is circulating so widely in Brazil that it is possible, and I would say likely, that new variants will appear in the near future.
He's calling for an international task force, including pharmaceutical companies, to get vaccines to Brazil right now. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Rio de Janeiro.
I do not have a valid license.
If you're hoping to go on holiday in Europe this year, you may need to prove you've had a COVID jab or a recent negative test. The EU has today unveiled its proposals for what's been called a vaccine passport. The president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, set out the plans for the digital green certificate at a news conference in Brussels.
It shows or states whether the person has either been vaccinated or a recent negative test or has recovered from COVID and thus antibodies. Secondly, the certificate will make sure that the results or what it shows, the data and the minimum set of data, are mutually recognized in every member state. And thirdly, with this digital certificate, we aim to help member states reinstate the freedom of movement in a safe, responsible and trusted manner.
But that announcement was overshadowed by threats to restrict exports of coronavirus vaccine doses made in the EU.
Open roads run in both directions. And this is why we need to ensure that there is reciprocity and proportionality. And I want to be clear on reciprocity. If the situation does not change, we will have to reflect on how to make exports to vaccine-producing countries dependent on their level of openness.
Medical apartheid.
The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present.
These days, there are lots of ad campaigns aimed at promoting vaccines and debunking myths about them. Last week, the Ad Council launched its ad featuring four former presidents, including Barack Obama.
It will protect you and those you love from this dangerous and deadly disease.
The Biden administration plans to ramp up its own vaccination campaign in the coming weeks. Many of these campaigns aim to reach a Black community hit hard by both COVID-19 and disinformation. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
As far back as 9 months ago, pediatrician and health activist Rhea Boyd noticed social media posts citing false information about the safety of vaccines in development.
Before any of the vaccines had reached emergency use authorization, we already saw that disinformation targeting Black communities online.
The State Department since blamed Russian intelligence operatives for spreading some of those rumors. But at the time, Boyd says,
it wasn't clear where it was coming from. You know, it would just look like a user would sow seeds of doubt. It doesn't look like a campaign for misinformation. It looks like a bunch of users who are sharing their own conversations about what they think about the vaccine and what seems like insider information.
Boyd decided to push back with her own campaign. She framed hers, too, as a conversation, one based on questions her family and neighbors were already asking. She says many of the questions people have about vaccines are universal, but many people in communities of color can't get answers because they lack access to medical care. Boyd works with the Kaiser Family Foundation and historically Black colleges. This month, they posted a series of videos, including one featuring comedian Kamau Bell, posing questions to Black medical professionals.
First question, the vaccine happened fast, like super fast, like Usain Bolt headed to the bathroom fast. Is that something we should be concerned about?
Having an emergency authorization for these medications was critical, but that doesn't mean any steps were cut.
Boyd's campaign is emblematic of many efforts around the country seeking to reach diverse populations with information about vaccines that is both factual and relatable. Boyd called her campaign the conversation between us about us, referencing, Boyd says, a phrase often used to signify Black-led initiatives, for us, about us.
Knowing that Black folks would recognize that, knowing that people would say, oh, this is like for us, like this is an inside conversation inside the community.
She says such intimacy and authenticity are critical for these messages to be heard. Reverend Anthony Evans says the Black Church developed its own methods of fighting disinformation. Evans is president of the National Black Church Initiative, a network of 150,000 member churches. It organized in 1991 in the midst of a crisis caused by the crack epidemic. The group offered social services and advocacy to the Black community. Now, Evan says, it also functions like an emergency alert system, relying on volunteers to keep an ear to the ground and track local threats to their community and church.
We got a very sophisticated communication system in the Black community that very few people know and understand, and that's where we can mobilize so quickly.
Over the past year, Evan says, the combination of racial unrest, voter suppression, and disinformation about the pandemic has kept the alert at its highest level.
We raised the code to purple.
He says last year, volunteers flagged disinformation campaigns designed to suppress the vote.
We was able to filter through that to get a very clear message to African Americans. You have to vote. You have to vote early, and you can vote by mail.
Similarly, it's through this network Evans first heard false rumors about the vaccine.
I got 150,000 ears in any zip code in America.
And Black churches, Evan says, reach 30 million people on a weekly basis. So now he's working with healthcare workers in those churches to help get this message out.
The Black doctors tells us that the vaccine is good for us. The ministers support that, so we want you to get vaccinated. That's a strong message in our community.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
We've been reporting for a while, actually, on vaccine hesitancy among Black Americans. Thing is, a recent NPR Marist poll found that they are not especially hesitant. About equal proportions of Black and white respondents said they don't plan to get a COVID-19 vaccine, yet in many states, there are racial disparities in who has received the shot. Dr. Rhea Boyd is a pediatrician and public health advocate in the Bay Area of California. Doctor, you wrote in the New York Times that the primary barrier to COVID-19 vaccination is access, not hesitancy. But, Doctor, why do you think all we seem to hear about is all about how Black Americans are vaccine hesitant.
You know, it's a great question. It's a question that I ask myself. You know, I wonder if it is a part of the same ways that we sometimes blame individual patients or patients of color, like Black folks in particular, for many of their health ailments. We say the reason that you have higher rates of diabetes or higher rates of heart disease is your own individual choices. You know, your cultural choices to choose what to eat shapes your disparity rather than the structural environment around you that might place you in a food desert. I think in healthcare, we have had an analysis of what drives racial health inequities that centers on individuals rather than on our systems. And that has led us not to really confront racism as a cause of racial health inequities, including right now during the vaccine distribution.
You wrote that access matters and that when Black people are given the opportunity, they do get vaccinated. So when it comes to vaccine access or a lack of it, describe exactly what you mean by that.
Yeah, as a pediatrician, I know that Black parents vaccinate their kids. So back in the 1990s, our federal government said, let's eliminate cost as a barrier to vaccination for children, and they created the Vaccines for Children program. That program then saw narrowing racial health inequities throughout the 90s, and by 2005, there were no gaps between Black children and other racial and ethnic groups for receipt of regularly recommended vaccines like MMR and polio. When Black parents have the opportunity to vaccinate their children, they do vaccinate them.
So maybe the bigger problem is an access to information, a lack of access to information. But you know this as well as I do, misinformation about vaccines in general predates all of this. So how do you overcome that?
Exactly. This is why Black healthcare workers across the country and I started working to create an information campaign just for Black folks about the COVID vaccines before a single vaccine had emergency use authorization. We knew that there were already baseline information gaps about how vaccines work and particular concerns that folks in the Black community had about this vaccine's development and their safety. Their concerns shared across all racial and ethnic groups. And so we put together a campaign to actually tackle that misinformation so that when folks make the choice about vaccination, they can make an informed one.
And that campaign is called The Conversation Between Us About Us. And then, Doctor, thinking about things long-term, thinking after this pandemic and maybe before the next one, how do we ensure efforts to improve access to healthcare for Black Americans remain ongoing?
Yes, this is a critical question. So we know that in this country, 1 out of 5 Black adults are unlikely to have a regular provider. They don't have somebody that they go to who they trust for their clinical care. We also know Black folks have some of the highest rates of uninsurance and underinsurance. And so those are easy solutions that we can target right now to ensure that we expand the network of our healthcare services, place primary care clinical sites right in Black communities, make going to the doctor in the United States free, cover it for people, particularly people who we know have suffered from the chronic effects of racial segregation and chronic discrimination, which shapes health outcomes. I think that would go a long way in ensuring that our health system no longer undertreats the needs of communities of color and Black folks in particular.
That's Dr. Rhea Boyd, pediatrician in the Bay Area of California. Doctor, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
Letter of thanks. Dear sisters, brothers, comrades, and friends, and family, on the move, how can I thank you? These, my words, can hardly measure the flood of love that you have radiated on my behalf recently. I am almost, almost without words. But I'll try. Thank you, Wadia. Thank you, Pan Africa. Your support from Philadelphia to France, from points across the nation, and literally around the globe, have pulled from a prison cell and placed me in a hospital room to be treated for a condition I didn't know I had. In the age of pandemic, now indeed deeply doubted pandemic, as of January 2021, over 300,000 prisoners have tested positive for COVID-19. Imagine that. In a cell, trying to breathe with a weight pressing on your chest. Imagine an elder man or woman, or even a young person. Because yes, we are also in an age of mass incarceration, which day by day increases its infliction upon the elderly, struggling unsuccessfully to breathe, to walk, to be. I thank you all for reaching out, and I urge you all, let our mission be abolition. I love you all. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The FBI is asking the public to help identify more of the people who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. A new series of videos on the FBI website shows the mob punching and beating officers. It also shows rioters using what appear to be batons and baseball bats and dousing some police with chemical sprays. Still, some have falsely claimed that the Capitol rioters were not really armed that day. NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach reports on why that's just not true.
Not long after the Capitol riot, Republican Senator Ron Johnson said this.
The fact of the matter is, this didn't seem as like an armed insurrection to me. I mean, when you hear of armed, don't you think of firearms?
Mm-hmm. It's become a popular narrative that the Capitol riot was not really armed. It's also misleading. First, let's talk about guns. It is true that the only gun fired on January 6th was by law enforcement, who killed rioter Ashley Babbitt. But the Justice Department has brought gun charges against at least three people connected to the violence at the Capitol, though those three are not alleged to have breached the building. One of those defendants, Lonnie Kaufman, allegedly parked his truck near the Capitol filled with what a federal judge called a small armory.
Authorities seizing from Kaufman's truck multiple firearms, a crossbow, and a cooler containing particularly lethal homemade Molotov cocktails.
Prosecutors have also cited evidence from Facebook posts and witness statements that other rioters brought guns onto Capitol grounds, too. Capitol Police estimate around 800 people breached the building, but the vast majority were not arrested or searched at the time, so we just don't know exactly how many might have been carrying guns. But the other weapons people were armed with, those were plainly visible from the footage that day. FBI investigators say there were batons, fire extinguishers, baseball bats, clubs, at least one stun gun, as well as pepper spray. Those weapons are often classified as less lethal, but police expert Lorenzo Boyd says they can still be deadly.
What we do know is there were a lot of other weapons that could be lethal weapons as applied.
Officials say more than 100 officers were injured on January 6th.
Multiple law enforcement injuries!
Suffering gouged eyes, concussions, and damaged spinal discs. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick was allegedly sprayed by two rioters with an unidentified chemical and died the following day. Authorities still have not identified his exact cause of death. NPR has been tracking every single criminal case related to the Capitol riot. It's now more than 300. And of those cases, we've identified nearly 40 that reference a suspect wielding some sort of weapon.
This was a pretty heavily armed crew of people compared to what you usually see at protests.
That's Heidi Byrick, co-founder of the Global Project on Hate and Extremism. She's followed extremist groups for decades.
Even when you see people who are armed at protests in states, for example, where they have open carry laws, they aren't storming into a building using the weapons in the way that we saw at the Capitol.
What's clear is that given the weaponry seen on January 6th, things could have been a lot worse. But Byrick is concerned that efforts to downplay the violence are less about the facts than about politics.
There's a reluctance on the part of some in conservative circles to accept that domestic terrorism is largely coming from right-wing extremist groups.
And to actually confront violent extremism in this country, she says we have to be clear about just how dangerous it can be. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
The video is just 9 seconds long. Its consequences could last a lifetime. Tonight, two frat brothers from Sigma Alpha Epsilon have been expelled from the University of Oklahoma after leading a chant that they'd rather black people be lynched than join their fraternity.
This is St. Louis Public Radio. Washington University students are reckoning with the role of Greek life on campus. Hundreds of students have left traditionally white fraternities and sororities they say contribute to racism and sexism. As St. Louis Public Radio's Ryan Delaney reports, some are working to abolish the Greek system.
Nana Kusi pledged a sorority her sophomore year, looking to expand her social circle. Kusi, who is black and originally from Ghana, says she knew joining a traditional white sorority could be problematic.
There were definitely red flags at a lot of points, but a lot of those were sort of just calmed by the environment in which you're in. It's very peppy. There's a lot of chanting. Everybody's smiling. Everybody wants to get to know you.
The extroverted Kusi, now a junior, says she initially got a buzz from meeting so many new people during the rush process. But looking back, she noticed she and other black students were being paired with sorority sisters who looked like them.
The rose-colored glasses of the experience, that wore off pretty quickly.
She says she realized the relationships were not genuine. Kusi quit Alpha Phi in July through a process known as deactivation. The wave of departures by her and hundreds of others traces back to a social media post made last summer in which a WashU student made a detailed accusation of racism in a sorority. A year ago, more than a third of students belonged to one of more than two dozen fraternities and sororities. Since the summer, nearly half of them have canceled their memberships, two sororities completely folded. Early indications show fewer students signed up to take part in Rush this spring, but the university says it doesn't have official numbers yet. Senior John Harry Wagner quit the Beta Theta Pi fraternity last year. He says he and others tried to make reforms and even talked with the National Beta Organization.
And the problem I think we kept running into is the fact that the system is not made to create safety for the people within it. And comparably, the system is not made to be inclusive.
Fraternities on campus have a lot of sway over the social scene because they have campus houses and can hold parties. Wagner says they tried to make those parties safer for women and others.
In the end, when a group of a whole bunch of men own a house where you throw a party to mix with women, it can't really be safe.
National Greek Letter organizations and their oversight bodies say they understand the need to change. They say they're committed to making their organizations more inclusive and welcoming. Danny Weatherford, CEO of the National Panhellenic Conference, one of two sorority umbrella organizations, says those conversations have been put on fast forward.
The modern sorority woman, or the modern Panhellenic sorority woman, is increasingly diverse.
WashU Interim Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Rob Wild says addressing students' concerns is more complicated than just kicking the frats off campus. Chapters could simply relocate or operate in the shadows without oversight.
We're certainly listening to the students that are bringing these concerns forward, and we always support our students to work to try to create the type of campus environment that they want as students.
But for Kusi and other students, total abolishment from campus is the only solution for a social system built around exclusion.
Because it's really a question, at least for me, about the value system that we have at this university. Are we going to choose to institutionalize systems of racism and misogyny and classism? Is this really what we're going to put our weight and our money behind?
Because, Kusi adds, any organization should be about everyone making friends with anyone, not a select few. I'm Ryan Delaney, St. Louis Public Radio.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Arlington mother Monique Brown Bryant said her son's football team was subject to language no one should have to hear when they played Marshall High School here in Falls Church 2 weeks ago.
They were being called the N-word repeatedly. They were being called boy.
She said a Marshall player even spat on a member of the Wakefield High School team.
Spitting on somebody is one of the most vile actions you can do to someone.
Brown Bryant said a fight eventually broke out. In response, the Virginia High School League told us it strongly condemns racial slurs of any kind. It also confirmed some players were suspended. But Arlington Public Schools said the three suspended players represented Wakefield. The district took offense to that. In a statement, it called their suspensions unfair. It also criticized a, quote, lack of action by officials refereeing the game, a sentiment Brown Bryant shared.
The athletes did exactly what they were supposed to. They told their coaches. The coaches were telling the officials, the referees, and the referees chose not to do anything.
Fairfax School says it does not accept intolerance and that it's conducted a thorough investigation into the allegations placed against Marshall High. Meanwhile, Brown Bryant says she's had to have a hard conversation with her son.
How did that conversation go? How have you been talking to him about the situation as it transpired?
He asked a very simple question that I didn't have an answer to. And it's, what happens next year when I'm gone and you're not there to protect me? And that's a heartbreaking question.
The Officials Association says it has an established track record of enforcing rules about racial slurs and offensive language. It says stopping incidents like these are a point of major emphasis. John Henry, WUSA 9.
Many mourn the killings in Georgia. A troubling new report casts a wider lens on the growth and dissemination of hateful speech around the country. Amna Nawaz looks at the alarming levels it's reaching.
That's right, Judy. That report from the Anti-Defamation League shows the amount of white supremacist propaganda nearly doubled in the last year. That included racist, anti-Semitic, and anti-LGBTQ flyers, stickers, banners, and posters. The report noted more than 5,000 incidents, or over 14 a day. Cases were found in every state, with the exception of Hawaii, and at least 30 groups distributed this kind of material. The three groups were responsible for more than 90% of it. For more on this, we're joined by the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt. Jonathan, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thank you for being here. When we're talking about this distribution of propaganda, where is it going? Where is it being displayed? How is it being delivered? And also, why this increase in numbers now?
Well, a few things. So first of all, this what's so ugly about this moment in time and this what we uncovered with this report is that these stickers, these flyers, these posters, these leaflets, they didn't show up in the dark recesses, a place where you wouldn't find it. They show up in very public spots, in college towns, in coffee shops, on Main Street, which is exactly the intent of the extremists who dropped this propaganda. What they want to do is to find ways to get their message out to the masses and terrorize people from marginalized communities who see this kind of content, right? So it's a very deliberate effort to infiltrate society, and they come out of the shadows to do it, and then with flyers and stuff, they can retreat back into the shadows. So again, it's intended to engender fear, to spread anxiety, and really create terror.
And what do we know about why you're seeing this disturbing increase over the last year? Do you have reasons for it?
There's no question that in 2020, we had an environment where extremists weren't just emboldened by the rhetoric of politicians like the president himself. They were actually energized. because he and his fellow travelers, from White House staff to members of Congress to elected officials, would repeat their rhetoric, would actually credential white supremacist media for White House events, as inexplicable as that may be, and simply refuse to consistently and clearly and cogently call them out the way prior generations of elected officials always had done. Republicans and Democrats across the board used to routinely recognize the threat that extremism and hate would pose to all of our society. So when elected officials fail to do that, when people in positions of authority look away or dismiss it, or even worse, tell these people to, quote, stand back and stand by, or suggest that, you know, you're very fine people, that isn't a dog whistle. It's a bullhorn that they hear and they feel validated, and that gives them even more momentum.
I want to ask you about another report this week because it is related. Intelligence and Homeland Security officials released an unclassified report on domestic violent extremism. Among the highlights, they say that extremists who are motivated by race or by ethnicity, as many of these white supremacist groups you're talking about are, that they present, quote, the most lethal domestic violent extremist threat. Have you seen evidence of that, of an increase in violent or lethal attacks in correlation to that increase in this kind of propaganda?
Well, there's no doubt that we've seen a surge of hate crimes in recent years. We can simply look at the numbers of anti-Semitic incidents, where after a 15-year decline in 2016, they went up 37% in 2018, in 2016, 30-some-odd 7%, in 2017, 58%. In 2018, of course, while the number may have dropped 5%, that brought us the Tree of Life massacre, the most violent anti-Semitic act in American history. And look, from Tree of Life to El Paso, back to Charleston, to Charlottesville, to even the events in Atlanta this week, I think what we need to recognize is that those aren't outliers, if you will. Those are actually data points on a trend line. And what that trend line tells us is that this environment has been conditioned to the point where prejudice has become simply more pedestrian, hate has become part of the public conversation, and bad actors feel like their impulses can be acted upon. So I think we're in a very precarious position. And what it shows us, and we should also recognize, is that it can start with name calling, and then it moves to propaganda, to violence, and then ultimately it can to vandalism, and it ultimately escalates to violence. So if you don't interrupt intolerance, if you don't step up and push back on prejudice, it can metastasize into something much worse.
Jonathan Greenblatt, CEO of the Anti-Defamation League, thank you for being here again. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Listen, just touching on some real issues right here tonight. That's all. I want y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the sonics, my man Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Then. Stay back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you got to do right by it. Minnesota.
Ain't no black people in Minnesota.
We're expecting some major decisions to come down this morning in the Derek Chauvin case. The judge is expected to rule on a request to relocate or delay the trial, even though 12 jurors have already been seated. Chauvin's attorneys made this request after Minneapolis city leaders announced last Friday they were paying George Floyd's family a record $27 million to settle a civil lawsuit. News of the payout has complicated the already tricky task of selecting an impartial jury. Here with more is Washington County Attorney Pete Orpett. Hello, Attorney Orpett.
Good morning, Kathy.
And we're also joined by our reporter, Brant Williams. Welcome, Brant.
Good morning, Kathy.
Pete Orpett, I'm going to start with you. The city of Minneapolis is taking heat, as you know, for announcing the settlement with the Floyd family just as the Chauvin trial was getting underway. Yesterday, the Minneapolis city attorney said he saw no downside to announcing the civil settlement in the middle of the trial. That's even though two jurors had to be excused because of how the payout was affecting their views on the case. And as you know, Judge Peter Cahill is clearly upset about how all this is playing out and the publicity around it. I'm going to play this clip of tape. Here's the judge at the end of the day yesterday after the city's latest comments came up in court.
I'm not going to talk about it. I've asked Minneapolis to stop talking about it.
They keep talking about it. We keep talking about it. Everybody just stop talking about it. Let me decide what the ramifications are.
So, Pete Orpett, at this point, what's the likelihood that Judge Cahill is going to move the trial out of Hennepin County?
Well, I don't believe he will for a number of reasons. I can go into those. One, look, the legal consideration is not pretrial publicity only. If that were the case, we'd be trying this case in Yellowknife Northwest Territories. So the thing is, has the pretrial publicity so pervasive in the community that it has essentially tainted the entire citizenry from making a fair judgment and listening to evidence?
And the other reasons?
Well, that's it. That's the only reason to move it. Pretrial publicity has tainted the jury so much, or the jury pool, that we can't get a fair trial. But here, Kathy, that's been proven not true. In fact, they're a week ahead, in my view, of how much time they put to pick a jury. It's gone actually remarkably well. Now, I think it was a catastrophe that the city had announced that settlement, as does Judge Cahill, but it's out, and it hasn't really affected their ability to pick a jury. I think they picked four yesterday. They've got 12. Mm-hmm. They need two more. So that's the legal part. Now, the practical part is millions of dollars have been spent on security, National Guard, pleading on standby, essentially shutting down downtown and the courthouse. Practically, that would be just a nightmare to start over again. He'd have to declare a mistrial and move it. I can't think where he could move it in Minnesota where he wouldn't still have the pretrial publicity.
You mentioned that you thought that there was a big mistake being made to announce the settlement right before the trial really gets started in earnest. Why do you think the city decided to settle with the family before the trial concluded?
Oh, I think they're doing everything they can to avoid another incident like we saw back on June 1st and 2nd. And so they thought that would assuage some of the angrier people in the public. They could have done that, Kathy, if they'd have just simply said, we've reached an amicable settlement with the family, and we will announce the terms after we're done trying all four of these officers.
How likely do you think news of the settlement could be grounds for an appeal if Chauvin were to be convicted?
Oh, he'll certainly raise it. But once, Kathy, it's not just the fact that there's been pervasive pretrial publicity, but has that publicity so deeply tainted the citizenry that they just can't possibly get a fair group of jurors? That's been proved not true yesterday. Now, you know, we're having to dance around that big elephant called $27 million, but people have said they can keep an open mind notwithstanding that and hear all the facts. And that's exactly what we need, just people who will keep a fair and open mind.
So you say you don't think this trial is going to be moved. Could it be delayed, though?
I don't believe that either, Kathy. My prediction right now is, especially after yesterday, Judge Cahill's going to keep going forward. He's got 12 impartial jurors ready to go. He needs two more. He's a week ahead of the time allotted. Again, there's been so much security put into this thing that he just has to keep going forward. The public really is insisting upon it right now, and it's the right thing to do. If he had real trouble with the jury selection and they just went through maybe 150 people and still couldn't find anybody, then they'd look at maybe moving it to Grand Portage or Laverne. But wherever you go, you've got pretrial publicity. So we can't stop there. We have to look at, has that been so pervasive that people have made up their minds? And here, that hasn't been true. Apparently yesterday, people said they could set that aside. It wasn't really relevant. They haven't heard the facts, and they're willing to judge them on the merits. And that's as good as it gets.
All right. Pete Orpett, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure talking to you.
That's Washington County Attorney Pete Orpett. So I'm going to turn right now to our reporter, Brant Williams, who's been covering this trial. Brant, so there's this, you know, we expect the ruling about whether the trial would be moved or delayed. There's another big ruling, though, we're expecting today from the judge, and that's whether Derek Chauvin's attorneys will be able to introduce evidence of a separate incident from 2019 in which Minneapolis arrested Floyd. Talk about that.
Right. So this is evidence which actually Judge Cahill has already decided was not relevant. But since he made that ruling, there's been new evidence that the defense says should be brought in. Now, Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, says basically that that evidence from this previous arrest in 2019 shows what they believe is a kind of propensity by Floyd to swallow drugs and try to hide them from officers. And that his response to the officers back in 2019, they say he acted erratically. He cried. He started crying. He called out for his mother. He said that was due to the ingestion of drugs.
What do prosecutors say about that?
Well, so the prosecutors say, look, this is a way just to for the defense to smear George Floyd's character. Earlier this week, prosecutor Matthew Frank told the judge he felt like the defense was trying to send this message that because Floyd took drugs, that he doesn't deserve sympathy. Judge Cahill actually said, look, I may consider some of the medical evidence from that 2019 arrest, but he strongly pushed back against anything that would essentially put Floyd himself on trial. And he said, quote, you don't just dirty up someone who has died under these circumstances as a defense.
So meanwhile, prosecutors are going to fight this notion that George Floyd was resisting arrest during this fatal encounter with the police last year. Do you know how they're going to make this point?
Yeah, well, yesterday, prosecutor Jerry Blackwell argued that one of their expert witnesses, a forensic psychiatrist named Dr. Sarah Vinson, will basically rebut the defense's contention that Floyd was resisting arrest. Although he said Vinson will not provide an actual diagnosis of Floyd's condition.
It would be more the general testimony from Dr. Vinson that a person who has encountered a traumatic event, as George Floyd had, just any general human, would be expected to have a reaction that would manifest anxiety, et cetera. And here's what this looks like in terms of behaviors.
And prosecutors also believe that Dr. Vinson will show that it's more likely that Floyd died as a result of the force used by Chauvin than he did from some other medical cause.
And when does court start this morning?
The judge is going to make his announcement at 8:15 this morning.
All right. Brant Williams, thanks so much. You've done great work.
Thanks, Kathy.
Get some rest, Brant. And also our thanks to Washington County Attorney Pete Orpett.
One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. Hey, baby! You got girlfriend, Vietnam? Not just this minute. Yeah. Well, baby, me so horny. Me so horny.
You keep lying.
Me love you long time. You party?
Yeah, we might party.
When you are
how much?
$15?
$15 for both of us.
No, it's you $15. Me love you long time. Me so horny.
Asian Americans have been the target of racist attacks and violence since long before the COVID-19 pandemic. What we've seen in the past year actually fits into a deep history of anti-Asian violence in the United States. Here to walk us through some of that history is Beth Lou Williams, history professor at Princeton University and author of The Chinese Must Go, Violence, Exclusion, and the Making of the Alien in America. Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of folks are shocked by the uptick in violence against Asians and Asian Americans over the past year. But as I said, it really shouldn't come as a surprise given our history. How far back does this kind of violence go?
I mean, unfortunately, the anti-Asian violence goes back to when immigrants first came to America. So the first cohort of Asian immigrants were Chinese miners that showed up in the 1849 for the gold rush in California. And when they arrived, they faced both violence from individuals in the minefields, attacks and lynchings, but also they faced violence from state officials, from tax collectors and police. And we see, unfortunately, that this was just the beginning of violence against Asian groups.
And what about the violence against Asian American women specifically? That is one of the things that's been really startling in the data we've seen about hate crimes since COVID-19 is how disproportionately women in particular have been targeted. Is that part of the history as well?
Yeah, I think we have to, again, go back really far to understand this, that Asian women have long been hypersexualized in sort of the Western imaginary. And that goes all the way back to ideas of Orientalism, that the Orient was a place of the exotic, and that the Orient was seen as this feminine space, a place where women were more submissive and accessible. And there, it feeds into ideas of Western domination. And I think it's also linked to sort of the particular history of Asians' interactions with America. In the 19th century, there was trafficking in Chinese women to America. And I think that, that trafficking then fed stereotypes that all Asian women were sort of hypersexualized in this way. The other thing that I think is really important to understand is that much of the sort of violence and exploitation of Asian women has happened overseas. You know, America has fought a series of wars in Asia, in the Philippines, in Korea, in Japan, Vietnam. I mean, in all of these places where there's been significant military presence, there's also been militarized prostitution. And so that means that, in fact, America has a long history of sort of exploitation and violence against Asian women in those spaces as well.
I mean, perhaps to put too fine a point on it, but I mean, did you hear any of that when you heard the police officer say that this shooter in the Atlanta area was responding to his, quote, sexual addiction?
Yes, I definitely did. I mean, and I think that it's disturbing that the police are trying to draw a distinction against sort of that misogyny and anti-Asian racism. I mean, these two things can't be taken apart, because for women, for Asian and Asian American women, they've always been connected.
Let's walk through a little bit of the history. I mean, are there sort of patterns that we can discern in terms of when we see these kinds of spikes in anti-Asian sentiment? For example, is it related to economic instability or disease outbreak? Are there any patterns you can point to?
Yeah, I think that because Asians have often been seen as marginal to American society, they've seen as sort of outsiders. For that reason, they've made easy scapegoats during times of, you know, heightened anxiety over many different things. So, for example, heightened anxiety about economic inequality and unemployment in the 1870s and 1880s meant a large amount of violence against the Chinese. You know, but we also see it not just around economics, but previously around disease. So in San Francisco, when there was fears of the bubonic plague in 1900, there was sort of a forcible quarantine of Chinatown and threats of vigilante violence if the Chinese were to leave. And this quarantine, I think it's important to note, only involved the Chinese people. White people could still go in and out of Chinatown at the time. And then I think you also have to link it to things like Japanese confinement during World War II, known as Japanese internment, that there was violence after Pearl Harbor against Japanese in California and in the West, and then this forcible rounding up and moving and confining of Japanese people by the American government. You know, these, I think, again, it was a reaction. It was heightened fear in that case to war.
Why do you think this history is so poorly known? Why do you think we struggle as a culture, Americans, to hold this information?
I mean, I think it's linked in part to just a lack of recognition of Asian American history in general. It's not just specific to violence. But I also think that this omission is not just about violence, that there's also been an omission of Asian American history in general. And I think that that in part reflects the current day status of Asian Americans, that they're still seen as outsiders, as new arrivals in our society, and and therefore marginalized in our textbooks and in our culture. I think that non-representation matters. But the other thing I would say is that I think a lot of this violence was effective, unfortunately. It did something, you know. So when it comes to the 19th century, a lot of that violence pushed people out of communities. I study how groups expelled large numbers of Chinese immigrants out of, you know, more than 165 communities across the American West. These expulsions erased that history effectively. And I think that, so this violence is tied to that that outsider status.
Beth Lou Williams is a history professor at Princeton University and author of The Chinese Must Go, Violence, Exclusion, and the Making of the Alien in America. Beth, thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
What would your response be? Because there are a lot of Black people, non-white people, who they saw photographs or video of Elliot Rodger, and they said, "Oh, I think this is a white person. I think this is somebody who had quote unquote white privilege. He lived a very opulent existence. He had a BMW and writes about going to all of these very rich and fancy places and going to Hollywood premieres. His dad is a big time movie maker. I think this guy was white, and he clearly has no problem expressing his disdain for Black people and even other non-white people. He killed 3 Asian people. He makes a lot of comments as well about how he doesn't like Asian people, both in his manifesto and online. Other non-white people, this guy, he wanted to be white. He is thinking in the same way as racist man, racist woman. I think that this guy was just white, and then he went, and particularly him going out and killing 3 Asian people. What would your response be?
Well, I would say that he despised himself not being white, and therefore he despised his roommates who were also Asian and non-white. I mean, it's no different than Black people shooting and killing one another because they have been taught and treated being oppressed under white supremacy and being demeaned and degraded in a system of white supremacy. So they are consciously, subconsciously taught Black self-hatred, and they go out and harm and kill other Black people. So the people of color, the people who are non-white under white supremacy, this is a tragic, oppressive system. And the reason I talk about it, so we can all, instead of pretending that it doesn't exist, we can all look at it, talk about it, understand it, and change it. As long as we don't talk about it, then we don't see how we are impacted by it. And the kinds of things that occurred in the case of Elliot Rodgers and all of the black-on-black homicide and violence and killing, this is a reflection of non-white people hating themselves. And they are taught these lessons in the dynamic system of racism, white supremacy. So I'm not at all surprised. Again, understanding racism, white supremacy, that this kind of Asian self-hatred, Black self-hatred, non-white people disliking themselves. Probably if you tested people who call themselves Hispanic, if they could all change and become really white tomorrow, would they do it? I would dare say yes.
The deadly shootings around the Atlanta area this week have put more attention on violence and harassment against Asian Americans. NPR's Juana Summers reports on what the federal government is doing to respond.
Even before the Atlanta area shootings, the Biden administration was taking steps to address the recent surge of violence against Asians and Asian Americans. In his primetime address on the coronavirus pandemic, President Biden denounced vicious hate crimes against Asian Americans.
It's wrong, it's un-American, and it must stop.
Earlier this month, senior White House officials held a listening session with more than a dozen advocates and community leaders. Attendees of that meeting, and others held by Attorney General Merrick Garland and Justice Department officials this week, say that Biden's efforts have been a welcome change after former President Trump used racist references in his descriptions of COVID-19.
It's really nice to meet with our national leaders and leadership without, in a place where they're offering help.
That's Joanne Yu of the Asian American Federation. Now Yu and other leaders say they want the administration and the Justice Department to take concrete steps to respond. John Yang of Asian Americans Advancing Justice pointed to the department's Community Relations Service.
Their job is to interact with the community, and not in a law enforcement way, not in a prosecutorial or criminal way. Rather, their job is to go to meet with community members and also serve as a bridge to bring different community members together.
The Department of Justice says the service has been active in AAPI communities since the start of the pandemic. On Capitol Hill, Democratic lawmakers are reintroducing legislation meant to bolster law enforcement's response to hate crimes against Asian Americans. Among other things, the bill would designate a Justice Department official to speed up reviews of hate crimes reported to federal, state, or local law enforcement. Biden supports the bill. But many of the examples of racially targeted harassment and violence may not meet the legal definition of a hate crime, leading some to call for lowering that bar. Cynthia Choi is a co-founder of Stop AAPI Hate. One thing she says the Justice Department needs to do is to make sure that resources are available in a variety of languages.
You can't be a multiracial democracy and not recognize the fact that there are lots of people whose primary language is not English. We do that with the census. We do that, you know, with other types of emergency services, that we make sure that people can be served and get the information that they need to make informed decisions in language.
And the Justice Department has recently translated its hate crimes resources website and portal into more languages, including Chinese, Vietnamese, Japanese, and Arabic. Shekhar Narasimhan, the chairman of the AAPI Victory Fund, said there needs to be a specific leader designated. He's among those who has been bringing up the need for more Asian representation in Biden's cabinet.
Give us a point person. So every month we can have a briefing. That person can talk to us about what they've learned, what's going on, answer questions, and we'll bring together people from other communities that tend not to get listened to.
The Department of Justice has not named a point person on these issues, but a department spokesperson says it has more meetings planned with AAPI lawmakers and leaders. Juana Summers, NPR News.
The shootings in Atlanta have stoked fear among Asian Americans. In the San Francisco Bay Area, reports of violence against the community have been on the rise for months. There's discussion about how to stay safe, but there's a generational split about the best way to do that. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Julie Chang reports.
After a recent string of robberies and violent attacks against seniors in Oakland's Chinatown, a local organizer started a GoFundMe to hire armed security guards. So far, it's raised more than $85,000. And if you visit the neighborhood, you'll see the guards patrolling the area. Wang Kifu has been operating Ruby King Bakery in Chinatown for more than 30 years. Fu says he wants more police in the area, but since that's not happening, he welcomes the armed security guards and says they help community members feel safe. Fu understands the recent calls for defunding police and reinvesting that money into community programs, but he believes officials need to focus on removing bad officers instead of abolishing the police force at large, and he thinks police presence is still needed to deter crime. And Fu is not alone.
I ask all of our seniors in Chinatown, and basically all of our businesses, do you want to see police in this community?
Carl Chan is with the Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce.
So far, I haven't heard anybody say no.
But that sentiment isn't shared by everyone. At this rally, local organizers spoke out in support of crime victims. Many of the merchants and seniors in Chinatown are first-generation immigrants. But here, at this event, they tended to be younger and born in the U.S. And this generation is mindful of the ongoing calls for racial justice and police accountability.
Racial profiling is lazy.
Local activist Enner Chu is concerned about viral videos that show Black people hurting Asian American seniors. He fears they unfairly stereotype African Americans as criminals. At the rally, he denounced more police as a solution, arguing it pits minorities against one another and risks endangering Black lives.
It escalates the tension that makes violence against people and property more likely, and it makes all of us less safe.
Some organizers also say it's unclear if the attacks were racially motivated. Meanwhile, racial studies experts say there's a long history of white Americans targeting Asian Americans in times of crisis. For example, during World War II or the U.S.-Japan trade tensions in the 80s. Chu and others are calling for solutions that address the root causes of crime like poverty, gentrification, and lack of mental health services.
Our city and our nation is experiencing some challenges right now. As a result of some anti-Asian rhetoric that was
at a separate event a few blocks away, local leaders, both Black and Asian, called for unity between their two communities. Cheney Turner, an Oakland business owner, said the generational divide around policing isn't just within the Asian community.
It's the same with the Black community, right? Our older community have been conditioned that police keep them safe.
Turner says they're not upset at those in Chinatown calling for more police.
We need to have conversations with our loved ones and, you know, in communities to really explain why the police isn't and has not kept us safe.
Those conversations are beginning to happen. Chamber of Commerce President Carl Chan supports services meant to address the root causes of crime, but he's still skeptical.
Let me say this. When there are no crimes, we don't need the police.
He says with violence on the rise now, Chinatown needs more immediate solutions. For NPR News, I'm Julie Chang in Oakland.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, first day of spring, unless I'm misinformed, Saturday, March 20, 2021, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, counter-racist suggestions to share. The number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-POUND. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-POUND. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Many things to share, much like a number, I think, last week, many of the weeks throughout the COVID situation. Wow, lengthy list. Let's see. Number one, we will be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism. Irregular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Again, earlier so that we can get our folks in from around the planet. I think this will be our first time we can hear from some of our folks in London about the whole kerfuffle with the royal family, Meghan Markle and all that. I actually saw today they had riots in Germany about the they had a new implementation of COVID-19 restrictions because they've had, I guess, rises in the number of cases. And so they had riots in Germany. Folks, lots of white people mad, stomping up and down. Dr. Welsing went to study us. Wow, that's amazing. Anyway, but we will check in with them tomorrow. Will be good to get information from around the planet. Again, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific. Next, invest if you think the program is constructive, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Hit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. My review for Isabel Wilkerson's case, top post. Have to collate our O.J. Simpson book study session so I can put that in an easy spot as well. Once, hopefully, I can get a safe 5 minutes to calm my thoughts, I can put that together. But at least for right now, the review for Isabel Wilkerson's case is there. And then, upper right-hand corner, PayPal button is also there. Just beneath that, the link for Cash App. We are on Cash App at cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all of the investors all over the world who have invested, supported in the cows for a dozen years. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can hit the wish list, Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. Again, enormous appreciation, gratitude to all of the folks who have nabbed an item or three from the wish list all the way back since 2009. I don't think I even had the wish list until 2010. And in fact, today I got Dr. Gerald Horn's book, The Bitter Sweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. He even mentions the late Marvin Hagler in the book. I was reading that today. If I had footnoted it, I'd read you the page where he talks about all of the white gangsters and thugs who went to wager on the marvelous Marvin Hagler, Thomas the Hitman Hearns fight. And they called Tommy Hearns the Hitman, the real Hitman. They said they brought suitcases of cash in to wager on the brawl between these two niggers. Rest in peace to Marvin Hagler. Next. Man, I don't know if people have seen the film Full Metal Jacket. Maybe you need to see it, maybe you don't. I have played the audio segment, The Rifleman's Creed. That is what that is known. This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is... That's from Full Metal Jacket, right? Stanley Kubrick film. He's very popular white director. I think he did Eyes Wide Shut, Clockwork Orange, another classic. Anyway, I've played the Rifleman Creed audio segment a number of times over the years, but today we actually heard two snippets from Full Metal Jacket, Me Love You Long Time, all that with the Vietnamese sex worker, right? How important is that film? It is very highly, if you go to Internet Movie Database, it is almost in the top 100 films of all time. And I believe Clockwork Orange might be there too, but Full Metal Jacket. So what is the significance of that film in the culture of white supremacy? Here on The Cows, you've heard two sound clips just today alone. This is my rifle. Me love you long time. Lots of conversation about Vietnam of late. My goodness. Next, they were talking about the folks prosecuted at the Capitol. Talking about these folks were armed and all the rest of it. I saw a report at KCRW, which is based in Los Angeles or California. They were looking at the number of folks who've been arrested thus far, and they said right now it is approximately 300 people who are facing charges related to the terrorist activity January 6th, 300. Now, they estimate that it was approximately 800 people who breached the Capitol, and other reports indicate that there were approximately 30,000 people who participated in the initial march. And they said that not all of them were a part of the Capitol melee, but it was 30,000 at the march, and at minimum, about 800 or so who actually stormed the Capitol, and of that, thus far, only about 300 have been arrested. I said before, it doesn't look at all like they're seriously going to prosecute these folks, and they actually had a report at KCRW, is half enough. I'll read their data. It says, government officials believe about 800 rioters entered the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. About 300 people have been charged, and the government expects to charge at least 100 more, according to a recent filing. Is that good enough? Is that enough for deterrence? Ken White and Josh Barrow, they came on to talk about it. And I said, man, I want you all to think now. If the folks at the Capitol, if it had been a Cows project, a Cows radio project, that we are going to Washington, D.C., we are upset. Joe Biden stole the election, and we are going to, you know, exercise our constitutional rights to protest, exercise our grievances. So me, Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, Red in Ohio, like our whole little contingent. We go there and we're cutting a fool. And man, you all stole the election, Raron. Get that Nancy Pelosi. What are you going there and storm? Now, do you think half? Nah, you can't get them all. At least we got half of them, you know. Got the ringleaders, as they say. Is that what they did? Move organization? Is that what they did with the Black Panthers? They have all the trials. They talked about Panther 21, New Haven 7, the Chicago 9, all this. We just get half of them, you know. And the half that they have prosecuted, it's not, again, what do they call it? Fullest extent of the law. Throw the book at them. It's not like they've done that for the handful, deliberate metaphor, of people that they have prosecuted. Expect more of this. Continuing. They had the segment talking about two of them, talking about the COVID-19 situation and Black people being hesitant. The first segment, they said, hey, a lot of Black people are reluctant and they don't want to take it and Nurse Rivers and all the rest of it. We know what we'll do. We'll get some Black medical professionals and we'll put it in terms that they can relate to, you know? We know what we'll do. We'll get W. Kamau Bell. I would like, you know, to have like intelligent, logical conversation and, hey, you know, maybe we should evaluate, figure out what to do and all that. But I mean, to have this be like a consistent thing where it's, hey, we got to talk to the niggers about the vaccine. It's time to get serious. We got these old burrhead coons. They don't want to take the vaccine and everything. They're talking about conspiracy this and Nurse River that and Tuskegee this and rah. Okay, let's see here. Who can we grab? Make sure. Is Tyler Perry available? Let's see it. Tyler Perry, can we get him? Okay, you can't get him this week. Let's see. W. Kamau Bell, can he bring his white wife? No, that'll scare him. Oh, yeah, don't bring the white wife. Don't bring. Let's see. Can we get him next week? Let's see. Who can we get? Can we get Martin Lawrence? Maybe he can get his Shanae costume. Do they? Maybe we can get Dave Chappelle. Remember he did the skit? He would do the thing. Remember Rick James? We can get him to do that and talk about the vaccine. Kevin Hart, anybody else that cuts a laugh that we know they'll listen to? I have never been like more offended. Like, it has nothing to do with W. Kamau Bell. He's been a guest on the program. I predicted success for him in no way, shape, or form. If you had told me in 2010 when he came on the program and we debuted the cowbell, in no way, shape, form, in my wildest imagination could I have conceived that over a decade later, we would be in the middle of a global health pandemic, scale of which has been unseen in years. And the person that they would turn to help Black people get a better understanding about how to turn, W. Kamau Bell, who at the time I said was the worst program we'd ever done at the time. Again, BGQ, he's a victim of racism. No, it's not a slight at him at all. It's who said, what white person sat down and said, yes, we need to get Tyler Perry to come talk to Black people about the Rona. That will help them make sense and allay their fears. Yes, we need to get W. Kamau Bell. Like, what qualifies them? Like, what makes them? Why not get Charles Barkley? You know, anybody else you all can think? Can we resurrect Red Fox? Richard Pryor? I've never been more appalled. I can totally, totally understand it. This is the way that the messaging is going to be the Black people, that Black people are just Nurse River this and Tuskegee that, and, you know, we just got to go wait until Kevin Hart is available to talk sense to them. If that's the messaging, then I mean, hey, I don't even know what to say. You can feel free to come up with your own logic about the best way to proceed, because, I mean, wow, that is just racism at its finest. That is not what they do when it's time to go and talk to white people. I don't think they go and get Louis C.K., whoever, Sarah Silverman, say, come up and tell us a few jokes and, you know, get these white people to stop burning masks and be sensible, social distance and the like. Maybe I missed that. W. Kamau Bell, victim of racism. We heard some of the black farmers talking about being spat on and the like. I could have played that back and wished I had, because spitting came up again at the football game. Now, last week we were on the compensatory call-in, and there were so many reports I lost count of black. These are like not we're not talking about like LeBron James and Steph Curry. I expect white people to go to the game and call them a name, call them niggers and spit on them. We're talking about high school students. Sometimes these were 13-year-olds. These were not high school students. Sometimes they were like middle school and the like. Little black boys, little black girls being called nigger and all the rest of it. And I said, man, like, isn't the Rona still going on? Like, why are they having contact sports where it's already a risk with the Rona? And then you got racism on top of it. Like, that's what all this is for? I would rather sit in the house. We can, you know, get the PS5 and do some games or whatever, run around the block, stay in the house. I don't have to be called a nigger. I don't have to be spit on. And I don't have to worry about getting the Rona. Miss me with all of that. Another reminder, like, parents, do not have your offspring in any of these organized athletics. That's what you're signing your child up for right there. A good round of Jerry Sandusky. You see, they got that documentary on the Olympic team. That's what you're signing your child up for. Get raped and fondled by a white person or a non-white person. Or the other students. Or spit on and called a nigger. Maybe a combination of all three. No need to have them involved in any of that at all. What did I just say the book title was? Let me read it again. The Bitter Sweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and the Political Economy of Boxing. You could scratch out boxing, football, gymnastics, basketball, water polo, tennis. Serena Williams could tell you a whole lot about racism, racketeering, and the political economy in tennis, dominated by white women. Anywho, spit on at the high school athletic competition, and they don't do anything about it. A fight breaks out. Apparently, they only suspend the students from the team with the black players that were being victimized. Like, football, the absolute, like, the worst of the worst. Football, like, black people should not participate in football at all. Like, I'm not gonna have my child in it. Like nothing about this is safe. There's no way you can do tackle football and not get brain damage, and then on top of brain damage I gotta be called a nigger and spit on. I'm good with all of that. Pause right there, since I did say brain damage. We were talking about Marvin Hagler last week, and I think it was said that Marvin Hagler seemed like he was still relatively healthy and didn't, you know, suffer the damaging impact of having a lengthy boxing career, which he did have. He didn't seem like he suffered brain damage. Football, like boxing, there is no way to participate safely. You're going to get brain damage, period. Tackle football, boxing. I might be misinformed, but I think the science is pretty clear. And in fact, I have heard a number of folks who study boxing specifically. The human head is not designed to be punched. One punch can be sufficient to cause brain damage or kill a person, depending on how hard it is and where they hit you, much less years of being punched in the head like Marvin Hagler or Thomas Hearns. There is no way to endure that without getting brain damage. It's just a matter of how much brain damage. Next, they had the segment about the increase in so-called hate in America. Should have been an increase in white supremacy racism in America. And they had Jonathan Greenblatt, suspected racist, on. He said that Democrats and Republicans used to call out extremism. He didn't say call out white supremacy racism. Pause right there. So you're telling me in a system of white supremacy, Democrats and Republicans used to call out racist behavior? Really? They like to talk about Tuskegee. I don't remember anyone calling out, Democrat or Republican or independent, calling out Tuskegee until like Bill Clinton in the 90s. I don't remember George Bush the first having anything to say, or George Herbert Walker Bush, I don't remember him having anything to say about Tuskegee, or Ronald Reagan, or Jimmy Carter. They love him. Or Richard Nixon. When I think all of this broke in the 70s, I think Nixon might have been. I don't remember any of them coming out. Oh, my goodness. This is the worst thing ever. We are so sorry, Negros. We will never let this happen again. And that no good Nurse Rivers has it coming. I don't remember that sort of thing happening, much less all of the other incidents that we would be talking about over that time period. Like, in fact, Ronald Reagan came out and did his campaign in Neshoba County, where the three civil rights workers were killed. That's not calling out racism. George Herbert Walker Bush almost lost to Robert Dukakis. What did he do? They call it the Willie Horton campaign. He didn't call out racism, white supremacy. I'm like, what are you talking about? Anyway, or I even had a lengthier list. I went on and on and on. Timothy McVeigh in the 1990s. Remember we did that with O.J. Simpson? They had that big congressional hearing after Timothy McVeigh went and blew up the federal building in Oklahoma, and they had all the racist hate groups came and talked all that trash, said you're not going to push us around and have big government come in and have a replay of Waco and do the same thing in Ruby Ridge. All of that was front page news on the Day of the Gloves, 1995. I don't remember that being something that, hey, we have got to stop all of this right now. And obviously, it was a really lame, ineffective effort if they did so, because we wouldn't be here now if that were the case. But I don't even think they made a lame effort. Make sure I'm clear about that. Next. One of the first segments that I played, they talked about the increase in alcohol poisoning, hepatitis of the liver. I think that idiot, I think he says it often, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We already have enough health problems. We do not qualify for health under the system of white supremacy. That said, all of the commentary about the shooting in Atlanta, I'm sure folks will have things to share. Wow, so much I could say on that one. I guess one, I included the segment from Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, grandsister. Someone I think mentioned that they, when they started hearing all this about the anti-Asian violence, this was before the shooting in Atlanta this week, they said that they went back, they thought of Elliot Rodger, did the shooting in 2014. He has a white parent, non-white parent, that he had a lot of anti-blackness, anti-black sentiments about black people. And his frustrations and what have you. They said they thought about him and some folks. In fact, I had one person told me this week that in the midst of all of this, they went and downloaded all the programs that we've done on the cows about so-called Asians exhibiting anti-blackness. I thought, wow, that is curious. At no point in any of this, especially this week, but even before that, at no point in any of this has my thought been, Asian people do not like black people, therefore either I have nothing to say about all of this, or I don't care that this is happening, or, you know, Latasha Harlins, Akai Gurley, just gonna call out some, you know, incidents or Elliot Rodger. That has not been my thought process at all. In fact, that does not make logical sense, although it does fit a pattern I have observed, but to me, that is not logical. And I was so thankful to hear Dr. Welsing say that. For the folks, I guess that is one thing I could say. Well, if they did go back and download the broadcasts where we've talked about anti-blackness exhibited from so-called Asians, perhaps, hopefully, they will hear Dr. Welsing, because she was here two times in 2014 to discuss Elliot Rodger program, or her 22nd visit. And her 23rd visit specifically. But that snippet, I thought she had so much wisdom to share. And incidentally, I called Neely Fuller Jr. this week. And I asked him, I said, man, have you seen incidents of black people being blamed for abusing and mistreating Asian people? And he said, no. I said, okay, well, he doesn't, you know, check online and such. I don't think he's checking all the news in the world. And I said, well, what do you think if, you know, there are victims of racism, so-called black people who say, hey, Asian people, they exhibit a lot of anti-blackness, or it comes up frequently. And, you know, I'm not going to go out and protest or throw any support, sympathy about these cases. And he said, I could totally see racists, white supremacists. Yes. Thank you kindly. That will help us stay in business. We go out and mistreat non-white people, and the other victims look and say, eh, they don't like us. I'm not going to be involved with that at all. And Mr. Fuller was pretty emphatic and immediate. Victims guaranteed qualified. Not like we all have to agree with Mr. Fuller. I'm just telling you about a phone conversation. He immediately said, now, are we going to try to pretend that all black people like and support other black people? I don't think so. And I said, yeah, particularly even amongst Cal's listeners, when I know the conversation, if Yamiche Alcindor had been one of the victims, it couldn't even have been, hey, that is horrible out here killing black people and Black Lives Matter, because it would have been, whoa, I don't think her parents were born in the United States. Whoa, she's not ADOS. Lots of reasons that we come up with not to support non-white people who are victims of white supremacy. When I say it fits a pattern, it's the same thing that I've heard repeatedly all year long. That's the exact same thing that I heard last week. Black mom in Dallas, her 11-year-old son gets abused, and it wasn't, oh my goodness, and I'm not saying everybody, but it was a lot of folks that I heard. It was, oh my God, what kind of lame parent is she? Why are you having your child hanging out with some white? You should have known better. You get what you deserve. That was what I heard with her. Meghan Markle, I heard a lot more of it there. Like, oh my God. Like, what are you doing marrying some white man? Like, didn't you read Pam's book? Didn't you read Renethia Tate's book? What is wrong with you? Oh, well, you make your bed, you got to lie in it. Metaphor. Heard a whole lot of that directly. Like, people that I talked to, like, face to face, people that I heard online, like it was tons of that. Even you can go all the way back to Eric Garner. It wasn't even that people found that Eric Garner specifically did something wrong. It was just other black males who maybe look like Eric Garner did something wrong. So therefore, I'm not going out to protest, and I don't care what they did to him and choke him out, whatever. Doesn't have any concern with me. No count black males, or no count black Asian, or no count Asians, or no count mixed race people, or whatever it is. In my view, anytime a non-white person, victim of racism, is harmed, and the response is some form of they deserved it, or I don't care, or whatever the case, all of that supports racist woman, racist man, and racist child. It certainly doesn't mean you have to go out and protest or make a sign or invest any money, but I don't think the response should be, I don't think these people like black people, because I have concluded, no doubt, black people don't like black people. I think I've said that for about 12 years. That is majorly underlying the cows. That's why we have anti-blackness hashtagged for every compensatory call-in. It doesn't say anti-blackness because so-called Asian people don't like black people. It says anti-blackness because of how black people have been conditioned to treat and talk about other black people. In fact, I'll even pause right here because Pam has been on my mind. One thing Pam used to talk about all the time, she didn't talk about how Asian people don't like black people. She would talk about specifically how black females don't like black females. And that is something that we do not want to talk about. She said, oh, we will get excited and call in and rant and rave. Black males don't like black females and all this and all this. Go, whoa, 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 whoa. Black females don't even get along with black females. And she said, with crickets. It's in the archives. She said, I've said this a few times and I generally get crickets. She said, I even got a few emails from times I've said it where people said, you know, you are correct, Pam.
Nobody likes anybody in the system of white supremacy. Racists don't even get along with racists. You see what happened at the Capitol? It is not about like, it is not about love, it is not about brothers and sisters. It is about replacing white supremacy with justice. I don't think failing to sympathize with other victims of racism or taking a position that seems like it's suggesting, they don't really like us, so I'm not concerned about that. I don't think that's going to help solve the problem. Incidentally, the whole narrative, I think after this week, I think it's done. The headline, if you want to use that term, the headline for anti-Asian violence for the foreseeable future is going to be Robert Aaron Long, who is classified as white. It was in the NPR report. I didn't even have that one to play with. So many, I could have picked a dozen. But they had it in the NPR report about viral videos of black people attacking so-called Asians. Again, I have not seen tons of these. And I'm in Seattle where there are lots of Asian people. That is not the concern at all. And regardless of all of that, the headline now is Robert Aaron Long, white man. Incidentally, I did see a few more, even other cases of white people going out and attacking so-called Asian people this week. They didn't even get honorable mention. It was all Robert Aaron Long, who is 21 years old and free white and 21. I was using that hashtag so much last year. I almost used it again today, but other things. 21 years old. I thought Obama told me young white people were behaving themselves. Not hardly. Anything else that I need to get? They said within that segment, they said that many of these cases of so-called anti-Asian violence would not qualify as hate crimes, so they were considering lowering the bar. That is a metaphor. I put an asterisk there. Major concern. I could see where I think what they mean is they would change the rules, right? So that maybe there are strict guidelines about, you know, it has to be certain behaviors or certain things have to happen in order for something to qualify as a hate crime. They might reduce that. So it will be, there are fewer restrictions. It'll be easier to categorize something as a hate crime. I could see that ending up being used against black people. I think we talked black identity extremists. It won't be that we're going out here to make sure that there's not another Timothy McVeigh. There's not another Dylan Roof. There's not another Robert Aaron Long. It'll be the Negro. What is the group? The not effing around anymore. Those will be the folks who will now. Oh, fewer restrictions. Hate crime. Bang. That's how I would expect them to use this. If it happens, I could be in error. Is there anything else? It would seem like I would have had something to say about George Floyd. I guess to some degree, I feel if it was any other week, I would have more to say about the George Floyd case. The jury has been selected, 7 white people. I would not be very hopeful about a conviction in that case. That said, another part, or from a different perspective, I've said also for years that I'm not very interested in police killings of black people and tracking those cases. So from a different perspective, I probably wouldn't have a whole lot to say. That is not a case I would be sitting around and watching every day and reading all the updates and all the rest of it. I was curious to see what the jury makeup was going to be, but beyond that, we will see when the verdict is reached. I will not, as they say, hold my breath. All of that said, if we could not use metaphors for the broadcast, that would be super appreciated. I just used, they said, lowering the bar. There were a number of the different metaphors throughout the audio segment. Frequently, race soldiers, they will use metaphors to spread confusion. Often, victims of white supremacy, myself included, we have been exposed to this misbehavior. And sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views, so we will substitute, use an analogy, comparison of some sort, and that just creates more confusion. If we could be direct, specific about what it is we would like to say, that would be appreciated. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, that would be great. Make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would also be greatly appreciated, so we don't have to hear you coughing and other people talking and on the TV, or if you got music in the background, just to minimize the distortion. Unmute, get to a quieter area, share your thoughts, and then you can mute your line. If you have additional thoughts, then you can just unmute and rejoin us. Much obliged. The number again is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let us see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Greetings, Irie in Louisiana. I just saw a report today. They were talking about Louisiana being one of the areas where they have so much environmental racism and pollution that is causing cancer. Well, the Cancer Alley is right there in Louisiana. That's what they were talking about and trying to get serious about solving that problem, environmental racism in Louisiana. Irie, yes, ma'am.
Thanks for letting me speak. Good evening, everybody. I don't think they're serious about that, because I just read a couple of weeks ago about another, some type of industrial waste complex they want to build in St. James Parish, where my family that I can trace is originally from. Golly. Yeah, so I want to share something that I started substituting again, some racism that I've seen since going back into school under the new COVID guidelines, restrictions, and just how they're treating non-white children in the school districts. I wanted to say to the parents, please, please, please limit your children's time on these cell phones, on these apps, social media apps, because when I last taught in 2020 middle school, I kind of noticed that, you know, their attention spans were short. You had about, I don't know, a minute, maybe 2 minutes to engage a child or a group of children, you know, with something, whatever it is. And then they probably would like start going off back into their head. Now it's like 15 seconds or less. If you haven't said what you're going to say in 15 seconds or less, they're off and gone, like to something else. And it's almost like they didn't even experience what you just said or what the activity was before that time. And it worries me greatly, because if this is the program and they're receiving, I'm not sure how they're going to even be able to function on a it is not good. I went into a classroom. I had my schedule changed from a substitute teaching position to a paraprofessional position. But I said, okay, I'm here for the kids. You know, it's a service to them more than me. So I went along with it, and I ended up pairing up with a non-white Black female who was in a SED class, special education. And so when I first met her, I had to escort her to the bathroom, and I was outside of the bathroom while she was at the mirror, I guess, primping or something. And she was speaking about how her teacher was mean to her. So I said, if you're having problems with your teacher, tell your mom to email the teacher. And she said, well, she did that already. So we were walking back to class. And then I said, well, listen, if your mom is having trouble with the teacher, have her talk to someone at the school district. And I kind of saw she didn't understand what I was talking about. So I explained to her, I said, you know how people have bosses? I said, your teacher has a boss, That's the principal. The principal has a boss, and those people work at the school district. And she said, oh, okay. So I was glad I imparted that on her. So then later on, we're in class during language arts. And what they've done at this particular school, the teacher has to teach children who are at home, remote. The teacher is also teaching other kids in another classroom with a supervisor on their iPads while simultaneously teaching special education students as though these children don't have particular issues that do or don't allow them to keep up. You know what I'm saying? This is, you can't, it's not saying they're stupid, but you can't, they need one-to-one, if not small groups. That's how you're supposed to do special education. So I was in there, pushed in. I was with a young lady. We were reading about some on Kemet, ironically. So I was like, okay, that's cool. You know, I already know a little something. So I said, come on, we'll read it together and take your time. The white lady goes, no, she needs to look up here. She needs to look at me. I said, my God, like, okay. I said, okay. I said, listen, take your time. So we read it together. We did the assignment. And then something I noticed in the particular assignment, there was one question that had two right answers, but you could only choose one right answer. I'm like, what kind of mind game are you all playing with these kids to make them think they're getting questions wrong when they're actually not? Because she chose the right answer. And then it ended up being another answer that was right as well. You see what I'm saying? It angered me. So I asked the young lady, I said, would you benefit from, do you feel like you would do better having your assignments given to you on paper? Because you seem like a paper kind of student. She said, yeah, my mom already told them that's what I'm supposed to have. She told them to put everything on paper. And so when the white lady switched out, a black lady came in that I had spoke to earlier, and she kind of sarcastically said, how was she? Did she behave? I said, you know, she actually did. Actually, we had a little break. I taught her a little bit of, you know, the ancient Egyptian language. I taught her how to say greetings, brothers and sisters. She said, oh, really? And the girl recited it for her. I said, well, can I be frank with you? I said, I've watched her. I said, I've been substituting a while. I think she would really benefit with a one-to-one like she had today and with her assignments on paper because it's too fast of a pace and the teacher doesn't have the time to individualize with her. And this lady said, oh, okay, I never thought of that. And I noticed how even the non-white teachers don't have patience. They don't have patience for the students. I'm not sure. I don't know why these people are in the classroom. If you can keep your children out of school, please do so. It's not benefiting them. Please teach them yourself or put them in a homeschool group. And again, keep them away from these phones. They are literally, it's a metaphor, but I feel like they're killing the brain cells. There's no way to develop good mental dexterity with the stuff that these kids are being exposed to and the continuous computer use, and they're just being rushed through. I did have something else to share, but I'll mute my line for now. Thank you so much.
Wow. I think the grandsister, she says, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. I think that's how she says it. I think that same idiot who says sobriety would be best, I think that same idiot, I think just before he says that, he's known for saying, help us be patient with other victims of racism, especially black children. Maybe we need to add that on specifically, but I'm not surprised to hear. I just said I haven't heard a whole lot of empathy with other victims of racism. So to hear that again, and I've seen that. Where even, in fact, Joseph Gibson wrote a book where he said the same thing, that he was seeing black and non-white teachers who thought about black children the exact same way that racist white teachers did. That when you said, I think the non-white teacher came in, it was kind of like, oh, how'd she do? Did she get to, like, gee whiz, like, she was great. I think just little more help? Can we get her an individualized educational plan where she could get some one-on-one time? I think she would blossom. I never thought of that. Like, wow, like that's incredible. One-on-one assistance for a black student. Like, that is revolutionary here in Louisiana. Bravo, Irie, bravo. Thanks for the encouragement as well to keep us, or I guess for parents to keep their children off of the cell phones, or at least to be try to minimize that time if they can. Let's see. Other folks, if you have commentary, line should be open. See, while folks are getting their thoughts together. Additionally, we should be here tomorrow for our Global Sunday Talk. We should also be here in the middle of the week. White author. I think we should be talking about food and health, I believe. Maybe even obesity once again, because that topic came up, I think it was last week. But just check for the middle of the week. I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday. We'll post the information. Always appreciate having white people on the program. Should be a white woman. Middle of the week. We'll give more details as we go. Probably tomorrow. Let's see. Other folks, their commentary. Ready to roll.
Greetings, Mr. Renegade. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening to everyone. To stay in order, I'd like to ask you, Mr. Renegade, do you have commentary on entertainment? Have I heard you say that that's not a discussion on the cows? I'm not, just trying to remember.
Woohoo! Thank you so much for inquiring. The compensatory call-in, the rule is no Area 8. That's sexual intercourse, and no entertainment, because people, we often get very captivated with television programs and movies and all the like, and that is, I don't think, or at least for this program, that is not a priority, talking about sex or entertainment. So, yes, if you could kind of table those, we can pick those up for later, but for this program, no entertainment, no sex.
Got it. Well, most of my commentary was regarding the entertainment, so I'll just go to the one thing that I took notes on, and that is the Asian women murdered. Since I do consider myself someone who thinks for themselves, I don't really address non-white dynamics as much who are not black. I personally don't think at this time black non-white people are able to be counter-racist strategists slash allies with other non-whites. I'm not there personally. It's not a strategic move on my counter-racist checkboard at this time, chessboard. So I have... regarding myself as a black female, I have enough to work on at this time, and I think our group, so I can't really focus on it. Having said that, I have no ill will against Asians, female, males, etc., or any other non-white group, and do not support violence, terrorism against anyone in the system of racism, white supremacy. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Right on. What was the movie or whatever it was that you were, I mean, not to go into detail, I didn't know we even mentioned like a movie or a film or a TV program or.
Yes, it was the trashy exposition on last Saturday.
What was on last Saturday?
Well, the entertainment program that came on last Saturday, I don't want to mention it unless you allow me to go forward.
I just wanted to know what it is that you're talking about, and I still don't know. So, yeah, I mean, if you can say the name just so I know, like, oh, that's what she's talking about.
The Grammys.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's all I yeah, that's exactly why. I feel like there have to be, like, at least 100 things that are way more important than what happened at the Grammys. Yeah, much obliged. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you kindly. And, yes, boycott the Grammys. Other folks who dialed in with a hand. Oh, and the certainly victims guarantee qualified. We are all supposed to be using our brain computer, as the Grand Sesta would say. I haven't seen any evidence that a substantial number of Black people are qualified to be allies, if we want to use the term ally. If that were the case, we would have made a lot more progress in solving this problem. In fact, the talk about entertainment, the movie with all the buzz right now is Judas and the Black Messiah. I don't think Judas is a so-called Asian person, but I could be, you know, VGQ. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I hope parents, God, Thomas, I hope parents are not spectating this week either, since we did have the vile report with the children being assaulted at the athletic contest. Make sure that would be another one you can share if you do have children. Share and have a code. What do you do? Hopefully they won't be playing football, but it'll just be in general. What to do if you're called a nigger or any sort of racial incident. Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir, I agree. The Black farmers. Oh, good evening to you, Gus, and all the callers. The Black farmers, I think they said they lost 90% of their land and they gave a year. And if that's the case, if that's what I thought I heard, I'm going to go back and listen again. I have a new argument for those people who we just need to walk out of white supremacy and buy our own land and grow our own food. You know, just a little argument to make toward that concept, which is illogical. Full Metal Jacket, the Me So Horny clip. Gus, I think you're a little younger than me. I don't know if you remember the song Me So Horny by 2 Live Crew. They also had a few other songs that were sexually connotated. I Wanna Rock and Pop That Coochie.
Uncle Luke.
And 2 Live Crew were banned from cities, states, and arenas, award shows, locked up and harassed for these songs. And then if you listen to 2 Live Crew and then listen to some of these female rappers today, like WAP, their vagina talks and all these songs, it's much worse. And they don't get looked at like Uncle Luke did. It's very interesting how the Black man was just ridiculed, or Black male was just ridiculed for having sexually connotated, to the point where they put the parental sticker, a parental warning sticker on the label, just so if the Supreme Court ruled that he could put his music out. I mean, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, but the women today, no problem. They get to interview politicians. It's just very, very interesting. What traumatic event did Mr. Floyd experience in the past? What I saw was he was getting arrested. He's been to prison before. He knows the procedures. They placed him in a police car and handcuffed, and somehow he managed to climb out the police car, and then that's when they murdered him in cold blood. But I mean, it's not like he hasn't been to prison before. I just don't get that argument. I don't see anything coming out of that case. During the Capitol invasion, what weapons were used? The only shooting I recall was of an unarmed white woman. And again, 275 officially classified riots during the summer of 2020. The police were attacked and blinded, but the news didn't cover it that way. And most of the attacks were happening by white people doing it to white police officers, from what I saw. And I don't think it's logical for black people to support Asian people and their anti-Asian racism campaign they're doing. Asians in particular, the Chinese people here in New York, New Jersey area, they've been here just as long as the Irish. They saw the Italians and the Jews get off the boats. And with the history of anti-black acts of white supremacy in New York, I don't recall getting a lot of Asian support. They were right here. They own their own neighborhoods, own all the businesses. Unlike us, they do well, but they don't support us. So that's why I'm against supporting them. So anti-Asian crime, white supremacist attack on Asians. He isn't a terrorist or a racist. He's a sex addict. I said, wow. Like, this is what they accused Halle Berry's husband to be, and the black guy she was married to, a sex addict, you know. Like, this causes you to kill people. I've never put those two things together, but they're trying to do it. That explains 8 women getting killed. I don't get it. Especially when obviously mentally ill, potentially homeless looking black male punches an Asian man and gets charged with a hate crime in New York, you know, and he doesn't even speak. He just punched him. But this guy, he's not a terrorist. He's a sex addict. It's just, Chinese people were depicted as weak in the movies. Their men were effeminate, usually laundry workers, people who refused to fight back against white supremacy. Their women were depicted as loose, usually sex workers or very naive, vulnerable female, easy prey for white supremacists. They changed that around. Today's Hollywood, they depict them as smart, intelligent, strong, on par with the white man and the white woman. Even able to go and invade the White House and White House down and stuff like that. Black men, we are the effeminate, weak, generally gay, drag queens in the movies. Black females are the loose strippers, not with a black male in the movie. So they kind of changed that whole thing around. And I had a VGQ comment, but I could wait until later if I've gone over my time.
Much obliged, much obliged, Thomas in New York. Lots of evidence. Well, yeah. Get to that later. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. This week, young fellow that I coached about, I think it's about maybe by now, almost 10 years ago, was killed on a motorcycle, and it was brought to my attention a few days ago. The reason why I brought it up is because this is the third former student / football player that I coached that was killed riding on two-wheeled vehicles. If some of the chances that young males take at early ages, like teenage years and whatnot, when they get their license, that sort of thing. I guess they like the freedom, I guess you may say, of the wind in your face as you're speeding down the street. But anybody who have young black male teenagers who are be interested in two-wheel motor vehicles, parents, attempted parents, try to discourage them from that type of equipment. Also this week, I was informed by a person to me that they are afraid that I would be dead shortly from the standpoint of tying an explosive instrument on myself to kill myself and somebody else. I asked, why do they think that way? I didn't get a real understandable enough explanation to report on the cows. But I think it has something to do with my my energy, my dialogue concerning the global system of racism and white supremacy. They didn't explain it from a thorough basis. I was curious about somebody that I literally grew up with, that they would have such thoughts. One thing I was brought to my attention by this person is that everything ends up being involved into that subject. And somebody can tell me different. I sure would like to know where racism is not involved in all nine areas of activity. And that's my report for this week. Thank you.
Carrying explosives. Make sure right. Not to invite you to any more yoga retreats. Like, my goodness. Like,
I'm telling you, never know what might be in that next pie.
Man. Next, we got Timothy McVeigh in training. My goodness. What is going on? The Opa-locka 3, that's the photo that they'll put out. Back, he's been militant for years. Back since the days after 9/11. We knew this sort of thing was coming. Explosiveness from the fire department. Miami Gardens. They'll have more news at 11.
I'm suspicious in thinking that the person also thinks that I don't ever have nothing good to say about white people. Which is, I would say, true. It's probably a lot of things I don't like that I don't like about black people. Something I don't like about myself as far as habits that I've tried to change. But anyway, stay tuned. I'll try my best to make the relationship better. I'll try to improve on it as far as that concern. I think it would be necessary. But anyway, thanks for everybody for listening.
That's rough. Wow. Militant. You don't have to do a whole lot to be described as militant. See, that's what I mean. They'll change the law and lower that threshold. That's what they said, lowering the bar. Then retired firefighter might be, you know, someone we need to watch, put him on the hate crime watch list. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed. Make sure I give out
Our number again, while folks are getting their thoughts, 720-716-7300, decode 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Neglected to mention, man, second young person, he said, dying on a two-wheel vehicle. Vehicle safety. Like, I think I also just saw that report today. They said there have been fewer vehicles on the road the past year, right, shutdown and everything, but an increase in the number of traffic accidents. Now, they've had a litany of reports from all across the country, so-called, about drag racing and all kinds of reckless driving since the roads were cleared, especially back when the pandemic, like the first 2 or 3 months when the pandemic first started, that lots of that was going on, and then people taking advantage, so you can drive really, really fast because there's no cars out on the freeway and such, taking advantage to go do donuts and all the rest of it. That's what it's been like the last 12 months. That's also something I would share if you have maybe younger drivers who are getting out, getting that freedom, as he said, go feel the wind blow through your hair and all the rest of it, especially if you've been locked in the house and all that. I can totally feel you the last month, but I mean, wow. See, I don't know what all that entails, if it's recklessness in general, racing, alcohol can be involved with that sometimes, that sobriety thing again, however it needs to be messaged, but wow, like that is in the midst of all of this, just regular old, you know, avoidable vehicle accidents. Like, man, buckle up, don't be reckless, certainly be sober if you're going to drive. Like, man, be all kinds of promoting vehicle responsibility if you have younger folks, especially with this past year, because it seems like there's been a lot of irresponsible and reckless motorist behavior with the Rona situation. Let's see. Folks getting their thoughts together, observations.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with, there was a metaphor used. I'm trying to remember what audio segment it was from, but this had someone going to walk back into the shadows. I don't know if it was the one with the shooting in Atlanta, or if it was with the Capitol riots, or maybe something else. But I thought that was an interesting metaphor. As far as the segment, I think they were talking about the sororities and how it was described. Maybe that was a victim of racism, maybe a black female. The term, I guess they thought the relationship wasn't genuine. So I guess they were at the point where they were beginning to discover that. I think that phrase, it doesn't get better than tacky, or that I may need to distance myself from this kind of environment. It may be causing stress and everything like that. And they may have also encountered racism, white supremacy, because that clip that, there will never be a nigger in SAE. Like, I remember that that chant. I think that was like in Oklahoma or somewhere. And I remember reporting how the white people on the job were saying, hey, you know, did they say this to you, right? They didn't say this to you. So they'll get into making comments like that, which is also them supporting racism. And the segment where the black students, it looks like they were punished, where I think that was the spitting incident. Definitely, I agree with the athletics. We should definitely reconsider or just not have the young adolescents, black teens, black children participating in that, because they, for the most part, will experience some form of white supremacy. And on the shooting in Atlanta, I do think it's racism involved in that, but white supremacy was practiced by, I guess that was, I can't remember that guy, the police chief or whoever that was saying, oh, well, you know, he was just having a bad day. And then when he was questioned about it, he was like, oh, you know, I didn't want to make it seem like I was defending him. But see, that's what they're doing. So that's even more racism being practiced. We definitely have to keep in mind that we are in proximity. I think that black people are in proximity with other black people a lot of the time. And the anti-blackness is for the most part going to come from other black people in terms of like neighborhoods, residential areas. I can't exactly like quantify in some kind of number or whatever. But it's going to come from other black people, people who are classified as white, definitely, who are responsible for this, and the non-white, non-black different groups and everything. And I was definitely doing some writings on this, like how they tend to have these different focuses and different ways of how they treat the groups that are not classified as black. I think, in my opinion, they have like different words and different ways of phrasing how they report situations and tragedies that involve the non-white, non-black groups, and how they report things that happen to black people. Like I noticed they haven't been really talking about forgiveness like they did with the Dylan Storm Roof and the things that happened to black victims of racism, and they'll turn around and they'll victimize Asian people or Hispanic, any other non-white, non-black groups. I just think they use different terms and different methods and how they victimize different non-whites. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. That is true. I have not heard any of the, do you, like, even when they go and ask the victim, like, do you forgive Robert Aaron Long? Do you forgive him for killing all these people? Like, I have not heard that pop up at all during this discourse. I guess we'll have to see, since he's alive and there should be a trial and all that, to see. And for sure, that is defending. He had a bad day? Like, are you serious? Like, even the sex thing, I mean, man, like, I'd have to do it to put the air quotes up, and, you know, he says he had a bad day. I mean, and in fact, you can even forget all that. I've seen police officers when they come out and somebody, I mean, all of this carnage, it would be whatever. He could say whatever. We are not tolerating this sort of behavior. We're going to investigate to the fullest extent of the law. We're not monkeying around with some bad day and all the rest of it. Like, I've seen enforcement officers come out and talk tough when there is major loss of life. And he even killed two white people. Like, come on. Let's see. Yeah. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Let us know what other differences you discern from your observations, studies. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Do not anticipate that we will be watching the George Floyd proceedings day by day. I will try and just be mindful about what's happening, so I'm not completely surprised when the verdict comes, regardless of what the verdict is. But we'll try to watch that
could see where that just ends up being a lot of racial theater for people to sit around and get their popcorn. And same thing like with the O.J. Simpson trial, smaller, not quite as big a deal, but I mean, lots of attention to see how all of that progresses over the next few months. I do recall the metaphor that was used, fall back into the shadows, or how it was said, recede back into the shadows, or whatever it was. I think that was with the report on the shooting in Georgia and saying that so-called Asian people were not going to fall back or recede into the shadows after this, that they must be heard and all of that. But that in the shadows, darkness, where the black people are in the shadows, not seen, not heard. All of those metaphors about darkness. We talked to darkness. We talked about all that before. Incidentally, if folks want another anti-blackness program with an Asian guest, you have to go way back. I think it's 2012 for Freddie Lee. Man, and that'll be even more fun for now, because he's talking about Jeremy Lin and the racism he faced, and he just had the allegation that he was called COVID in the NBA. But Freddie, oh, it'll be prescient for so many reasons. So we talked about all of that. Freddie Lee's classified as Asian. We also talked about black people calling him Jackie, black children calling him Jackie Chan, allegedly in Chicago, and his response to all of that. And he did a video, which he may have taken down. It doesn't matter because the audio was in the program, where he was talking, he was comparing Kobe Bryant to Jeremy Lin and talking about how Jeremy Lin graduated from Harvard and all the rest of this and what have you. And Kobe Bryant didn't even graduate from, didn't go to college, much of the grad didn't even go to college. And he's so stupid and he doesn't know anything. And Jeremy Lin, he's great athletic talent, he's smart, intelligent, and all the rest of it. So he's saying all this in the video, and then he's really getting excited, like, yeah, Jeremy Lin is the man, and that Kobe Bryant is nothing. Kobe Bryant, in fact, he's just a stupid gorilla. And he catches himself like, woo, can't call Kobe Bryant a gorilla. And he stops, and we had him on the, yeah, you have to go back and listen to the archive. Infamous Freddie Lee, that would be a great one. Even with that, I think I said before, man, I think someone had said that so-called Asian people don't support black people. I've heard lots of black people grouse and complain that black people don't support black people. The people who are most to blame for all of the non-white people not supporting other non-white people are classified as white. That notwithstanding, the cows cannot say that. We have had non-black people who have classified as Asian, supported the cows repeatedly over the years, like got the shirt and everything. In fact, even requested to come to the retreat and even stopped and said, ooh, would I be the only non-black person there? Would they be all right with that? And I said, I don't know. We will have to see. But that is not the case with the cow. The case with the cows. We do have non-black people who support and even would co-sign. Yes. And in fact, I sent that program, Freddie Lee, to one of our non-black investors. I sent it. I said, listen to this. Isn't this anti-blackness? Absolutely. And he absolutely was going to call Kobe Bryant a gorilla. Confirmed on both of them. But that'd be the, neither here nor there. Other folks, if you have commentary to share, we have about, I don't know, 10 minutes or so left in the broadcast. One more. I forgot. I used to, if you look back in the archives, descriptions, and writings, I capitalized A in Asian. I do not now. I don't capitalize B in black. I don't even use Latino or Hispanic, generally speaking, unless I'm quoting. So the only racial classification that I capitalize is the W in white. There is one race that is the individual or the white race. All the rest of the stuff that we're talking about, this is just nonsense that white people have made up. These are groups to be mistreated, especially the people we label as black. But I do not even dignify these titles with enough respect that they warrant capital B's for black and capital A's for all of that. It's just reinforcing racism, white supremacy, and the ideas that these titles, these groups, these races are real. They are not. They are just made up fictions of white supremacy racism, so no capital A for Asian, by Gus T, just like I do not capitalize B in black, just the W in white.
Renegade, you not black and proud?
I is black and proud, I think, quote Mr. Fuller on that one. I is black and proud, I think. That's about as close as I can get to it.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Gus. Can I share something?
Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am. Maybe you can speak up a tad or get closer to your microphone.
Oh, okay. Yes, is this better?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you kindly.
Hello. Okay, great. Yeah, really quick, I thought this was really important. Listening to, I don't know what podcast it was, but someone shared testimony from a suspected racist practicing medicine that is up for some type of appointment by Joe Biden's administration. And he was asked point blank, if he is appointed, would he make it a provision to ask children as young as 3 years old if they would like to start puberty stopping or blocking medication? And he went into some type of diatribe about trans rights and trans people, blah, 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 blah. And the other suspected racist asked him again, so are you saying you would support this? Is this something that would take effect with you in charge? And he obfuscated once more, and the senator said, well, let it state in the record. He has refused to answer the question. So I got curious and started looking it up because I couldn't understand why that would be even, you know, a fleeting thought for anyone, for children as young as three, who probably are just starting to talk. You know what I'm saying? Hey, you want to take puberty blocking medicine. So come to find out sometime last year, the UK, in the United Kingdom, there's been a ruling by their magistrates to stop allowing medical facilities to introduce this medical technique of, I believe, sterilization and mutinization to children because a non-white female by the name of Kiara Bell, who was 16 when she went to a medical facility, she was having an identity crisis, and they basically corralled her into mutating herself. They did a double mastectomy, put her on what they call cross-sex medicines, and now she looks like a young, non-white male, just about. She does wear female clothing. She's 23 now, but they did all this when she was 16, and I found it very interesting because I think it's another technique of sexual confusion in order to, again, totally mutilate, and in my opinion, mutate non-white people and make it where they can no longer have kids. And if this man is appointed, I really have to find out who he is, but it's not good. And I do believe we needed to know this information. It's sick and it's very serious. We really got to figure out a strategy soon. Thank you.
Wow. Can repeat that. Wow. When we play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. The Coon Man and fellow white medical practitioners, they generally take advantage of a lot of black people, but especially if they can get younger black people who, you know, are not as informed. Not saying if you're older, you're super informed either, but just you can be, it's easy to manipulate and take advantage of children. I mean, yeah, parental consent for a reason. That is ghastly. Wow. We will be mindful. Lots of reasons to be mindful about what's happening and do some investigating. Other folks, commentary to share?
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Yeah, so I do have a EGQ comment, and I hope that it is appropriate. So if it's not, cut me off, Gus. But it's based off of the last show you did with a guest.
I thought we were supposed to be operating off of a counter-racist code based off of logic. And I just don't see where it's logical for Black people to go to a wedding and view a tragic arrangement. Where in the code does that make sense? Are we in a race war or not? You know, my mother, father, sister, brother, cousin, I'm not going. They wouldn't, no one in my family would even ask me to go to a white person wedding. I'm the person who always talks about white people. And I just didn't get that. I mean, you know, your family member gets married and you want to stay around and be in a relationship, and then you're going to get a call from the bathroom from her, and her husband's sitting on the couch drinking a smoothie, and her face is half-bashed in, and she's expecting you to go over and do, I mean, like, sometimes points at the cold level, I've lost family members because of my cold. I just think that it's illogical to do that. And if I'm wrong for saying that, I apologize, VGQ.
Kicked them to the curb. Metaphor. I don't remember. I don't know about Renethia Tate specifically, but I don't remember anyone saying, or I'll speak for myself, I don't remember me saying that if a family member marries a white person that you have to go to the wedding. I know someone asked about what to do if you have a sibling or someone kind of close in your family if they marry a white person, and I said try to maintain the relationship. That doesn't mean you have to go to the wedding, but try to maintain.
No, it wasn't you, Gus. It was two people that called in. One, it was their sister, and the other one, it was a distant cousin. And I was just like, man, you have two people contemplating this. It just was so off code to me, and I apologize. You know, that's my code.
We all have our, you know, united, independent. Like, it is not the Black code. All Black people don't have the same code. It is united, independent. So I think the caller, our first caller, I think she said using, well, not our first caller, that was Irie, but one of our other female callers, she had said, you know, hey, using our brain computer, trying to do some thinking. That is what we are supposed to do to solve this problem. But yeah, I think my suggestion was maintain the relationship. I think that's important because I think Meghan Markle said, and I know we've heard for years, many, many victims have said when they end up in those tragic arrangements, they end up isolated. And if you can, if you have a victim of racism who you know is going to be mistreated, if there comes a point where they say, hey, they figure it out and they would like to reach out to someone, if you want to use Aaliyah Taylor, like, man, I was wrong. I need help. Is there someone I can reach out to? Family, someone I would, you know, that can be a good thing to have someone that you can reach out to who is willing to listen and who understands racism, white supremacy, who's not just going to say, I told you so. But, you know, for some folks, they feel like it's just not going to happen. That non-white person is happy and has made their choice and has got to move on. We have a number of folks who've made that choice as well, but just if there is a system of racism and they do figure it out, it can be good to have someone, what do they call it? A lifeline, I think they call it. Receptive ear who understands racism, but certainly VGQ. Anywho, as I said before, that sex thing will pull you in. They'll just take up the whole program. We'll just be talking Area 8 the whole time. Other folks, anything they want to get in that is not related to entertainment or Area 8?
Can I just say one other thing real quick about what you just said? And
Let's hear.
The relationship. Yeah, it's really quick. I agree, Gus and Thomas. This is why you want to maintain the relationship, because you could kind of compare it to an abusive relationship. If you cut off someone in your family or a friend that's in an abusive relationship, and they finally get to the point where they want to leave and they've been estranged from people, they won't really have a good way out with someone they have a connection with. So I definitely wouldn't go to a tragic arrangement ceremony, but I would definitely keep in touch with that person. I had a friend like that that needed my help because she was in an abusive or some type of situation where substance abuse was involved, I believe. And I did help her get out of that situation, even though she still went with another suspected racist. But Yeah, definitely keep the relationship alive. Well, keep it active. But yeah, don't go to the service. All right, thanks.
Much obliged, Irene. I can't say even with the CALS program, we've had more than one, I'll say it that way. Some of them even call in regularly. We've had more than one victim of racism who was married to a white person, started listening to the CALS, continued listening while they were married to a white person. We talk about their situation and what have you, and eventually did get to the point where they said, man, I'm married to a white supremacist and I have got to, you know, get an exit strategy together, and did get an exit strategy together. And I know for them, they said having those sort of resources to reach out was helpful. So not saying, just it can be helpful. But I think patience, having patience. Sometimes it can be good to invest a little patience with a victim of racism. Not saying you got to talk to them every day and, you know, all the rest of it. Or go to the wedding. Other folks, comments they need to get in?
Mr. Thomas in New York, can I ask you a question?
We'll say yes. He's probably taking
it. Sure.
Mr. Thomas in New York, I have a question regarding, you say that your probable counter-racist code would be to boycott a marriage between a white supremacist and a non-white person, particularly black person. My question is, have you considered what you would do if your offspring decided to marry a white person, a racist?
Absolutely. You should ask them what I would say. I tell them that all the time.
So would you boycott that wedding? Just curious.
The child in the wedding, yes, ma'am.
Okay. Woo. It's tough. But I got it. Just curious. Okay, thank you.
I'm just pointing out for listeners, this is why that rule is in effect. Exactly why I've concluded years ago, there's no way in the world this is the most important thing to talk about, or entertainment. There's no way in the world this happens every time. Area 8 comes up and that will dominate the whole rest of the discussion. Like, are you serious? All the things that happened this week and that's it? We're talking about hypothetical marriages now. Like, woo, anything non-Area 8 related.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to join in, but your last statement kind of like tells me it's probably not a good idea. But if I have your permission.
Gravity. It's got its own gravity. Did anybody have anything? So that's what folks are telling me. Nobody has anything that is not related to sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people on this week.
I did have one more thing. it was reported, and I don't know if it's true or not, that Tommy the Hitman Hearns said that Mr. Hagler had taken the COVID vaccination prior to this his medical situation, but Hagler's wife has come out and said that that is not true. So I don't know what's true, but I did hear that they were both mentioned earlier. That's why I mentioned it. Sounds a lot like Hank Aaron, though.
I did see that. It couldn't be. Tommy Hearns has CTE. Unless somebody could step out and tell me otherwise. So he's a victim of racism, but I don't know him to like be a reporter. Like, was he with Marvin Hagler when he got his vaccination shot? Like, where did he, does he have evidence to support that he did in fact get this vaccine, and that's what's called, Thomas the Hitman Hearns, Hall of Fame boxer, is not a reputable source for that's we've almost backed it. Tyler Perry, W. Kamau Bell, Thomas the Hitman Hearns. Like, what's going on with COVID? And I did see that, but I mean, whew, you have to give me some better reporting than Thomas the Hitman Hearns. And I didn't see, yeah, any other source of information. I think that's another. Now, see, even that, he's married to a white woman. Even that, we can't even get out of Area 8, man. Did anybody else have anything that is not related?
Well, I didn't know that.
to Area 8.
Yeah, I just found that out myself a couple of days ago.
Gravity, it just takes over the whole world. Everything comes about cowbells. Everything. If nothing else, because we'll be, and it'll be tomorrow, because the royal family thing will come up again when we get the folks. Although I do want to hear directly from people that are in UK, like, you know, what is their thought on all this? Do they care? Are they stunned that this is, you know, taking up so much time and energy? Are they worried about the Rona situation, the lock, because they are the lockdowns, the Rona passports and all that that's happening over there. Like, there are lots of important things to discuss, but that will be one. Hopefully we can get over that shortly and then get on to other things like the Rona passport and all the rest of it for tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk, 8 p.m. or excuse me, irregular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 p.m. Pacific tomorrow early so that we can accommodate folks different parts of the world. That will be looking forward, chatting in. Lots of things have been happening, and even to see, you know, how the so-called anti-Asian violence is being discussed in different parts of the world. Are they seeing these reports that so-called black people are supposed to be blamed for some of this, or is it just Robert Aaron Long has taken all the headlines up over there? We did our 3 hours and even snuck in a good bit about entertainment and a whole lot about Area 8. We'll try and do better. We'll be here tomorrow, and I think we should have a white woman here in the middle of the week also. We'll give details tomorrow. Should be on food and wellness, which is all related to racism anyway. Much obliged for folks tuning in live. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Whew, say it again. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I am very certain Dr. Welsing would co-sign on that many, many times. In addition to being sober, if you got to go, I mean, lots of violence to pick from all over. I would recommend being very alert. If you're going to be out and about, pay attention to what's happening around you. Pay attention to whom is around you. Anybody looks like they're being hostile, loud, rowdy, exit. This is not a time for confronting strangers. You should be thinking this person could be, in fact, talk about retired firefighter has explosives strapped to his waist. This here fella, or if it's a female, might have explosives in the vehicle and all the rest of it, firearms, and a whole cadre of individuals who are ready to do harm, that are just hidden out of sight. If you did not leave your residence prepared for lethal combat, ready to kill and die, get out of there. Very serious times. Our behavior should reflect that. Share that also if you are talking about vehicle safety with your youngins. Talk to them about safety in a very violent day and time. Being spit on at the football game and called a nigger and all the rest of it. That's it. If you got to go out, you are buckled. You are sober. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing the small things to stay away from the Mark Furmans of the known universe. In addition to being sober, not on the cell phone, we are doing all that we can to keep our attention so we can stay safe, make it back to home to our children, families, whatever it is. Another day to practice racism or practice counter racism, replace white supremacy with justice. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.